The House Interim Committee on Environment and Water. Happy New Year and welcome back. We have an agenda that includes our public hearing on the three member bills that were assigned to this committee, as well as one of our potential committee bills. We'll, in the second half of the meeting, hold informational sessions on several topics. Expect we will have time for a break between the two, but hope expect everybody to be back at 10:30 for the presentation on the climate. We will be taking public testimony on the three bills and the one legislative concept. There are sign-up sheets over next to the door for folks who would like to testify. This will not be the last opportunity to testify on any of these. Any bill that we intend to take action on will have an additional public hearing, at least one additional public hearing in February before we work any of these bills. With that, we have Bob is not here, so
that's true.
I am inclined to wait. Not having heard that he would not be here, I'm inclined to hold off on House Bill 3602, which is Representative Jensen's bill, until he is here to say anything about that. So I think that we'll move on to 3606, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3606. And Palmer, Justin, come on up. I have the sign-up sheet coming. Looks like it's the two of you and Kathy from DEQ as well. So why don't you tell us about this bill related to the electronic waste recycling program, which began successfully in Oregon last year and may require a little bit of legislation in February. Tell us about it. And Palmer, I think the committee's heard a bit about the program so far, but if you or Kathy want to remind us sort of how the program's worked in its year of operation and where we're headed, that would be helpful context before we get into the minutia of this very confusing, complicated bill. Short, but complicated bill.
All right. Well, certainly. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me Kathy Koala, who is the project lead on our e-cycles program. And the e-cycle program was something the legislature passed in 2007. And it's been very successful in setting up a program where TV and computer manufacturers have set up a system throughout Oregon where they pay for the collection and recycling. And to their credit, with the help of the department and local governments and the solid waste industry, we have a system that's very, very convenient. We have over 220 plus collection sites around the state. They're in every county in the state. They're also in every city of at least 10,000 or more. And so the Oregonians have an option to go to any of these sites and take back any brand of TV, any brand of computer, any brand of monitor, and the collection and recycling will be paid for by the manufacturers. And because the department oversees the program, we're able to ensure that that collection and recycling is done environmentally appropriately and that those materials are indeed recycled and recovered. Kathy can probably give you more specifics, but we have the program has dramatically exceeded the goals that were set out originally for the program. And just a note on how it works: if you're a manufacturer of a TV, a laptop, or a monitor, you have the option of, under the law, of setting up your own program to do the collection and recycling, or you have the option of joining the state contractor program. And the way DEQ set up the state contractor program is that we don't actually administer it. We have what they call a managed services contract, where there is a private contractor who really does all the work on that collection and recycling system. We just basically have a contractual relationship with that that entity. But it gives manufacturers options. So early in the prior calendar year, we let manufacturers know what their recycling obligations are going to be, and then they have the ability to decide whether, well, it's best for me in terms of cost, service, and all those other factors to elect to do my own thing or join with other manufacturers and create an organization to handle collection and recycling, or based on, again, cost, service, other factors, I can choose to join the state program. So it gives them flexibility. And Kathy will talk more about it. We've seen an issue, though, with the TV manufacturers, and some of you may have been around in 2007 when this legislation first came up and are familiar with, as Representative Cannon has explained it to me, Chair Cannon, the scramble to try and figure out what was the best statute to address the TV situation. And TVs are a bit unique. They are something where there's a lot of turnover among the businesses that make TVs. There's also a lot of turnover in the brands. A company will make a certain brand of TV for a couple of years, decide that that's not as marketable as another brand that they might make, and so you get a higher rate of turnover, and it's created some issues for us. And in particular, it's created issues for the state contractor program. And at that point, I'll just sort of stop and maybe let Kathy, who's the expert, go into the details a little bit more. But I wanted to give you a sense of how the program worked and a sense of sort of the issues that we're seeing. And I could, before we do that, I can take any questions, or we can just have Kathy talk more about
Palmer,
it.
Palmer, Kathy, how many pounds, tons of recycled material did we collect last year through this program?
Chair Cannon and committee members, for the record, my name is Kathy Koala with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. We don't have the final numbers in yet. They're due in on Friday. But up to the first 9 months of the year, we collected 14.3 million pounds of obsolete products.
So our goal was?
Our goal was 12.2 million pounds. And so within the first 9 months, we surpassed it. Which is something that we're seeing across the country also.
Great.
So it's a program that had some pent-up demand, I guess.
And if I could make one more point, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kathy, TVs are the, if you look at the pounds that came in, the greatest amount of pounds is TVs. It's something like 56% mm-hmm. of what we've seen. So that gives you a sense of how important TVs are in terms of paying for the program, because the fees and the way the program is managed is based on tonnage.
Great. And I think for the committee's sake, and this was clear from your testimony, Palmer, but just to underscore it, the way this program was designed, the manufacturers of the products are responsible for paying for this program, and they have various options about whether to establish their own program to collect material or to contribute to a state contractor program, but it's based on the manufacturers are responsible for paying, and it's based on their products showing up in our recycling program.
That's right.
So
That's right. That
I think gets at this bill and its attempt to change, alter the methodology for assigning responsibility for the cost of the program.
That's right. Why don't you?
So the issue that Palmer alluded to was that TV manufacturers, according to the bill as it was written, or the statute as it was written, received their recycling responsibility based on what comes back through the recycling system. That's what we call a return share. Computer and monitor manufacturers also receive their recycling responsibility is what's coming back through the recycling program. The way the law was written, though, and it was at the request of some TV manufacturers that came in during the writing of the bill, was that in the state contractor program, TV manufacturers would be assessed their responsibility based on their market share. So this makes the state contractor program participants have their fees assessed a little differently than if they're or have their responsibility assessed differently than if they were out in a independent manufacturer program. And that is actually the gist of the matter here. Some TV manufacturers would like to ensure that all TV manufacturers, regardless of which type of program they choose, actually are assessed their responsibility based on their sales, their relative sales to each other. And then also for our state contractor program, we're finding that because of the way this is set up, that any manufacturer, TV manufacturer with a sales a significant sales percentage is choosing another program because they then become responsible for too much of the financial burden within the state contractor program. Palmer, would you like to add?
Yeah, I'll just add 2 points. So Kathy explained one of the issues for the TV manufacturers, at least some of the TV manufacturers. I'm not sure that they're all of the same mind on this issue, but we're in a process of working with Justin and his client to find out and gather the TV manufacturers together to see where everybody is. But one of the issues for the TV industry is how do you assess the recycling obligation under Oregon's eCycles program? And there's a feeling among some TV manufacturers the fairest way to do that is by market share or that is by sales data. So that's one issue. A second issue is the state contractor program and a concern that DEQ has, and that is if we're trying to honor the legislative intent as we understand it, that in the policy decisions behind it, that would be that the state contractor program, it should be maintained in a way that it's a viable alternative to a manufacturer setting up their own plan, so that a TV manufacturer, when they go and they're given their recycling obligation and they have to pay for collection recycling in Oregon, they have a clear choice and a competitive choice between doing their own thing or joining the state contractor program, and that those programs are, you know, roughly equal choices that they can look at and then decide what's best for them. And the concern with the state contractor program is because when you get down to assigning the recycling fees that the contractor would charge anybody who participates in the state contractor program, that is done by market share, and that creates a disproportionate problem for TV manufacturers who have larger market shares, that they may leave the state contractor program, decide to do their own thing, and then at the end of the day, the state contractor program would be left with a lot of TV manufacturers who really don't sell many TVs today, but have high historic returns because the stuff that they made some years ago is coming into the system. And then the fees are based on market share, but since they have zero market share, they're going to pay little to no fees. So the state contractor program is left with this problem of how does it pay for itself? Because it has entities in it that, again, under the law, their fees are based on market share. They have little to no market share, but there are returns into the state contractor program.
If I may give one example.
Right.
Because it took us a while to wrap our heads around this, and I don't know if you've followed our logic through this, but for one example, for this year, we have one manufacturer who's in the state contractor program, and because the TV manufacturer, sorry, we're just talking about TV manufacturers, this one TV manufacturer, because they had a sales percentage, ended up paying for approximately 53% of the TV weight coming through the program, so approximately 2.3 million pounds. If they had been in a manufacturer program where they were just basing their responsibility on weight, they would have paid to cover only 1,200 pounds. So that's a significant difference, a significant impact to the manufacturer that is paying that and looking at that and trying to make choices about which program are they going to choose. So that's one very dramatic example, and we expect that this is somewhat of a downward spiral for us for the state contractor program, which is proving to be a very good alternative for many manufacturers.
Can you clarify something? You've said that in the manufacturer program, they would have paid by weight. The law doesn't specify that. The law doesn't assign responsibility for costs within the independent manufacturer program. That's up to the manufacturers who create a consortium to run the program, right? So there's an assumption here that they would be better off in another program because they have high market share and thus are penalized in a sense in the state program. But that depends on what the participants in the other, in the independent program, how they decide to organize their program and allocate costs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. If I may, Chairman Cannon, that is true, but I guess what we're seeing is, based on 1 year's experience, that if you are a TV manufacturer with a substantial market share, you now know sort of what you're going to get under the current law with regard to the state contractor program, and it's not going to be very favorable to you. I mean, you're going to see the examples of the current participants, or one of the current participants themselves are going to say this just isn't working very well, and they're going to have to look at these other options, either joining a consortium, and there are a couple of or several consortiums out there, or do their own thing. And so our concern was just, well, in the TV world, for TV manufacturers, does that mean that the state contractor program is really a viable alternative? And it would appear that it would be less likely to be that alternative if that's what's going to happen to someone who has a large market share.
Okay. Let me see if there are questions from the members of the committee. I have several more. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this a question of timing then? Because those that have a current large market share might be selling widescreen TVs, and those that are being collected are long since out of business. So that's the problem, isn't it?
If I may, Representative Benson and Kathy, if you feel like you need to weigh in, I think that's part of the issue, certainly. But I would describe it as what we are seeing is, under the state contractor program, there are a number of manufacturers. They're smaller manufacturers who have elected to join that program. So they don't really have much current market share. But what comes into the system after people have used their TVs for a number of years is the stuff that they previously sold. And it may have been quite a bit, because at one time they did have a high market share. They're just not the biggest kids on the block at the moment. But if you are someone who is an entity with a high market share, current market share, then the way the state contractor program works, because it assesses the fees on the basis of current market share, you are left with sort of a disproportionate responsibility. Does that help?
All right, Dennis, thank you. Yeah.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, and thanks for bringing that up, because that just actually became an issue in our family. We've never had a TV, but relatives who were moving had one of those very large, heavy, took two guys to, move it.
Right.
And I said, it would be better to get a small one, it would take up less space, the apartment is much smaller, et cetera. And they said, but what do we do with it? You can't take them to the dump. And I said, well, there are recycling programs. And, well, who pays for it? How much is it going to cost? Because dumpage fees are usually by weight. And everybody wanted to do that. So I was wondering how you're going to make this better for the older, the people, so that somehow it's going to be fairer for the TV manufacturers.
Right.
Because it's really not fair the way it is, it sounds like.
I don't know if you want to respond and tell her about the options in terms of,
Yes, Chair and Representative Boone. The manufacturers because of the way the programs are set up, they have some options to choose. They can choose to go with the state contractor program and pay that, their portion based on, for TV manufacturers, their market share. And if they choose not to do it by market share, they'll go into an independent program, a manufacturer program, pay it by their return share, which is, we don't have information on exactly how they're assessing their fees, but we're making that assumption since about 17 TV manufacturers that have about 88% of the current market share out there, and they are off in the manufacturer programs. So there are some, it's a basic choice for manufacturers to make. They have all stepped up, or almost all of them have stepped up to the plate to fund the program, so they are pulling their responsibility and meeting the law. But there are some different opinions about whether to go with market share or return share, and we're hoping that as we have a little bit of time in the next month or so to talk amongst the manufacturers that we'll be able to come to a good solution.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing the results of those conversations, because my recollection from 2007 is that, and I've expressed this to you, Palmer, and Justin as well, that there was considerable debate within the manufacturer's world about this issue, because if you're a retailer, a manufacturer, also perhaps a retailer, say, of a big, you know, big brands that are going off the shelf today, selling a lot of TVs today, but there's not a lot coming into the landfills through the, or coming into the recycling program, there's not a lot of your brand, then market share looks pretty bad, because you may have a big market share, but you're not actually seeing many of those brands that you own coming into the program. So why should you be paying the lion's share of the cost just because you're selling a lot of TVs today? On the other hand, there were, you know, those companies that own the brands that are coming into the program, but they're not selling a lot of TVs today, and they say, look, these are brands that we inherited. They, you know, have been through several different companies, and okay, so we happen to own this old brand, but why are we responsible? So this was a real point of debate, and I'll be, I'm certainly hopeful that the manufacturers, the owners of these brands all agree that it would make a whole lot more sense to use one methodology across the entire program. That would be nice, and maybe that will be the upshot of your conversations and what we hear when we bring this bill back in February. It was a point of considerable debate, and Jim and others who were part of that conversation will remember the back and forth on that.
Yeah, I mean, Jared Cannon, I think that's a pretty good description of the discussions that we'll have, that from what I hear from the TV manufacturers, they'll fall into those two points of view. Either I have high current market share, but not necessarily seen a lot into the program, or a lot of my TVs I sold some time ago and they're coming into the program, and I may not have very high current market share, and you'll have that tension between the two. There is one thing that may have changed since 2007, and we're going to look more at this, is that there are quite a few states who have either gone to market share as a way to assign recycling obligations for TV manufacturers, or are moving in that direction. And there's a certain logic in having Oregon follow what most of the other states do, so that is a factor that we're looking at and may play into where this all settles out.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just tell us how much money we're talking about dividing the responsibility for? What's the cost?
Do you have those numbers?
We have all of the programs look at it on a cost per pound basis, and so I have heard numbers anywhere from 25 cents a pound to 35 cents a pound so it can add up. For a TV manufacturer, because a lot of the older TVs, flat screens are pretty lightweight relative, but the older TVs can weigh up to 40 or more, 40 pounds, 40 pounds.
Yeah, and using the numbers you gave on the success of the program last year, and this includes them, IT, the computers,
yes.
But what was it, 14 million pounds?
In the first 9 months.
In the first 9 months, 25 to 35 cents a pound, you get a sense of the overall cost of the program split among, you know, dozens and dozens of manufacturers. But great. Super, Justin, do you want to add anything?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of Thompson Incorporated, which used to own and license the RCA brand. Mainly, we're just here today in support of House Bill 3606, and want to thank the committee for hearing the bill, and also want to thank DEQ, who we've been working with. We started late in the 09 session trying to hammer out some language. That's essentially what you see in front of you today. We support their opinions that, one, this really gets at the true intent of what the legislature did intend to do in 2007. We also think it makes a more fair and equitable opportunity for the TV manufacturers. And then finally, we believe, along with DEQ, that it makes the state program more viable. We also feel that this short technical amendment could be just that, a stepping stone. I think we've worked very well with the department in looking at options. How can we enhance the program, and what can we do beyond just this technical amendment to make the program stronger and work together throughout 2010 and hopefully bring something in 2011 that, again, continues to strengthen that program, not just for the benefit of the industry, but also for the state of Oregon. So with that, thank you. We're here in support of House Bill 3606.
Thanks, Justin. Any questions for any of the panel before we... Thanks. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation through this month and coming back. My sense is that this bill is not yet... it may require amendment, that it's not clear that the bill as drafted does exactly what's intended. So we'll be in touch, and please work with Beth to ensure that we have the amendment necessary to do what we want it to do.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3606. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3602. This is Representative Jensen's bill. He is on his way down. We have Martha Pagel here to give us some background on the issue. So come on up. Just a note, committee, while we have a minute, you undoubtedly have seen, or your staffs have seen, the calendar for February. While many committees are meeting in their, many policy committees are meeting in their same time slot that they met during the 2009 regular session, this committee will meet at 8 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So we have been moved to an early morning time. My daughter will have to endure some early wakings up on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but she seems to thrive on less sleep than I need. And it's amazing, but she's doing great.
How old is she?
She's 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5.
Oh, amazing. Time flies. Representative Jensen, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and my sincere apologies to the committee and to the chair. And to all of the folks, you know, that are in attendance here this morning, I happen to have the misfortune, or good fortune, as you might, however you might look at it, of serving on two committees that meet at the same time. And so I do appreciate your, you know, indulgence in sending staff out to get me to come over as you hear this bill, House Bill 3602. And I do have, you know, fortunately, able counsel sitting on my right that is going to, I think, answer your questions in relationship to this bill. It's a bill that has come to me at the request of Umatilla County Commissioners to solve a somewhat unique little problem that they have. And as all of us have experienced in this building, if you have little problems and it's simple little solutions to them, sometimes don't wind up being quite as simple as you might have thought they were when you began the process. So one of the things we do have, and I don't think I don't know whether you've received the from Beth the some of the proposed amendments that might be present on this bill, but we do have amendments that are proposed, and we just didn't get them to LC in time to have it in LC form as such. But with that, let me turn it over to Martha, and she can explain a little bit of what's going on if she hasn't already done that, and I'd be happy to answer at any time any questions that you have, and if they are too tough for me, why I'll simply take the advice of counsel on that.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm with Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, and I'm here today representing Umatilla County. And the county commissioners did want me to thank you for taking time on your schedule to hear this matter. And sorry that they couldn't be here in person, but they will be during the session when it comes up then. I'll just provide kind of a brief overview of what the issue is and what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. And as Representative Jensen mentioned, we do want to continue working with Legislative Council as well as with the Oregon Water Resources Department and other interests to see if there are some changes we can make to clarify the intent and make sure it does what we want it to do. But basically what we want it to do is to prevent the automatic termination or cancellation of an existing hydroelectric license and water right for a project in the Hermiston area. It's been operating as a small hydro project for a number of years, but a few years back ran into economic difficulty and ultimately was acquired by Umatilla County as a result of foreclosure for delinquent taxes. So now Umatilla County owns a hydroelectric project. And interestingly, we found that state law currently requires that when a project like this is acquired involuntarily by a government entity, that it requires the license be canceled, be terminated. And as best I can determine, the reason for that was that in years past, there was a process by which municipal corporations could obtain hydroelectric licenses that were different and really had more preferable conditions in them than would be available to private operators. So the thinking, I believe, behind the existing law is that the existing license would be canceled and the municipal government would then have the opportunity to obtain a new right under these other provisions. In this case, it really doesn't make sense for Umatilla County to operate the project. It makes more sense for them to sell it to a private operator, and they simply don't have that option. The consequence, if they're not able to do that, would be that the license is terminated. If the state license and water right is terminated, then the federal license becomes in jeopardy, and we've had indications that FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, would likely also terminate the license. So there's a desire here for a practical solution to allow this existing project to continue, and it requires a change in existing law to eliminate the provision that requires the automatic termination. We also discovered in working with Water Resources Department and the AG's office that there's a provision in the Water Resources Rules that's carried forward in the license conditions that says that if their non-use occurs for 5 years, for five or more consecutive years, then the license also must automatically be terminated. Now, those of you who are familiar with water rights know that it's pretty standard with water rights that you become subject to forfeiture, or there is a presumption of forfeiture after 5 years of non-use in the law. That's very well established. But our statutes for other water rights also include a long list of potential excuses or ways in which you may rebut that presumption, and including economic hardship. And economic hardship is by rule defined to include foreclosure proceedings. So if this were a regular water right and it hadn't been operated for 5 years or more, and in this case we're running up against that deadline, you would be able to present evidence that it had been in foreclosure, and that would excuse the non-use. So another change that we're looking for by this bill is to make it clear that there's not an automatic termination for non-use. And then finally, the bill would require an emergency clause and provisions to make clear that it is applicable to this existing project. Now, this is, as I've described, it's very fact-specific for a project in Umatilla County. But in working with the Water Resources Department, we also think that it is a logical and appropriate update and cleanup of the laws relating to hydroelectric projects. So it's not necessarily a specific interest project, but certainly it's one that's of great interest to Umatilla County, and we hope that it'll be able to go forward. We have been working with Oregon Water Resources Department. I've also been provided a copy of the concept to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm waiting to hear back from them, and have just begun talking with Water Watch and willing to talk with any others who are interested in the bill.
Thank you, Martha. You know, it would be helpful, if not today, then when we rehear this bill in February, would be a history of this particular project with when the license and the mm-hmm. rights were established and what has transpired over time. I think mm-hmm. While the bill, as it has to be, is relates to the law, it would be applicable to any project, it would be helpful at least to understand the general nature of this, to have the specific case in front of us, when this project was established, when the license was granted, the term of that license, the history of the right associated with that. It's still, for me at least, missing that sort of definition. So,
okay. Representative Cannon, members of the committee, just for a brief introduction, it was, I believe, constructed in the 80s. The initial license was issued for a 50-year term. It's a 1.2-megawatt project, which is pretty small. The information I have is that it would provide service for about 1,000 homes, but I would be happy to provide more details on that.
Representative Benz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. The ORS 543.440, I think you mentioned you went back and tried to find out why, and it would be interesting to see the memo that you mm-hmm. That was developed as a result of your research, just so we can understand. And I understand the thinking. I guess I understand the thinking as you've explained it. Maybe you could touch on that again.
Yes. Chair County Representative Bentz, the background that I have came to me from staff at Water Resources Department, so I have some additional work to do on my own to confirm all of that, but it's consistent with my understanding of how the hydro system works, and with the reading of the whole chapter 543 does have these preferences for municipal projects, but I'll be happy to provide more background on that.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Representative Jensen. And this is the first time looking at the bill, and so we'll want to be thinking about it. I'm sure several of us will, and make sure we help Umatilla County and understand the breadth or narrowness of application mm-hmm. of the bill, which is is the realm of my questions. My understanding, by a cursory look, is that this impacts just hydroelectric projects that are licensed. How? Say something, if you could, about sort of the breadth of that. How many projects might we be looking at? What other things might this impact? You know, will it really just address this particular project in Umatilla County, or will it go more broadly? What can you tell us about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't have information at this point on the number of projects that might be involved, and I can work with Water Resources to maybe get you more information on that. It's a fairly narrow classification of existing hydroelectric projects that also go through tax foreclosure proceedings. And it's hard to predict what those would be. I'm not aware of any others at the present time that would be affected by this.
Thanks. And another thing that would be helpful now and also as we go forward, sort of examples of what the world will look like, and I mean, you know, the kind of a narrative of what has to happen for the people involved in a project or live in the community, et cetera, with the bill in place versus with the bill not in place, right? Like, what's the best case scenario now, and what are the worst case scenarios when we do the bill, right? Or and also the best case scenarios. That also would be helpful to think about. And you might have instant responses, or you might want to, you know, you may have some later, now or both.
Chair Representative Smith, without the bill, we know that the project would be terminated under state law. Oregon Water Resources Department has already gone through a pretty extensive analysis, and they feel that they're headed on, that's an inevitability for termination of the license. Whether that necessarily results in removal of the project is an unknown. It depends on whether FERC would require that and some other facts, but I would be happy to put together kind of a more of a comparison of what the potential scenarios are and alternatives.
That'd be great.
Be happy to do that.
Yep.
And so just so I understand it, now, if things go forward, just explain to me, if things go forward as they are, the water right is forfeited. And that'll then go, you know, then whoever has other competing rights will be able to snatch that up, or you know, what'll happen to that? if we're able to make this legal change, then what is likely to happen to that water right? Is it's that the county is going to hold it, or it's likely to be transferred? Explain that, what happens to the water right in either case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, if this bill goes forward, then presumably the state hydroelectric license and water right that goes along with it would remain in place, so that would allow continued use of water for hydroelectric purposes. I should clarify that this project operates in the winter and spring months, so it's not competing with water needs for irrigation or for fish needs in the low-flow summer months. It also operates on a side channel of the Umatilla River, not on the main. It's on an irrigation canal offshoot. It's not on the main channel of the Umatilla River. But nonetheless, that means that the water right would remain in place, so they would continue to be able to use water during this time period. If the water right is canceled, then if potentially someone else could come in and apply for a new water right and new hydroelectric license on that project, but they would have to go through the process, and it would likely be difficult to obtain a new water right. It's hard to predict because hydroelectric is somewhat unusual. It's a what we call a non-consumptive use, so there may be ways to deal with that, but it would require going through the process of applying for and obtaining a new hydroelectric water right.
Does the county have the option of applying for a new license? So the forfeiture proceedings and the county's inheritance of the project will, under current law, result in the termination of the state license.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume it's a big deal to have to get these licenses. This is not, so I'm not suggesting that this would be a simple matter for the county, but is it, at least in theory, an option that would be available under current law, given that otherwise the license is terminated?
Mr. Chair, under current law, it would be an option to apply for a new hydroelectric water right, but some of you who have been around involved in hydroelectric for a long time will recall that some years back, the state of Oregon adopted some very strict standards for new hydroelectric that would make it very difficult to meet if you're starting from scratch on a brand new hydroelectric project, as opposed to renewing a license or extending it with conditions. And I know that some of the concerns about hydro older projects are that they may not have the kinds of fish protections or other environmental protections that a project would have today, and those typically are addressed in the license renewal process, and there may be an opportunity to address that kind of concern even now on this project. But the I think potential limiting factor here or major obstacle is that under the standards for siting new hydroelectric, we called it the no dead fish rule because it was so strict that it pretty much foreclosed new hydroelectric, whereas maybe if we were looking at establishing standards today, you'd provide more room for mitigation and consideration of management options that would avoid impacts.
But to be clear, if this bill passed as in the way that you intend the bill to read, the project would continue under its old license and old existing water right, and would not be up for renewal until 2035. So it's at that point that its 50-year license would be due for renewal, and at that point that these heightened standards would come into effect.
Mr. Chair, that's an issue that I'd like to come back to you with more information on, because yes, it's clear that at the time of renewal the project would be subject to new conditions, but it's my understanding that there have already been some discussions with ODFW and FERC regarding upgrades that could be made, and I just need to get more information on what's really been put out there and what some of the options might be, so that they would have heightened requirements applied at an earlier stage. I don't know for sure if that's an option, but I would be happy to look into
that. And I'd be very interested in following up on that. Representative Smith?
And so just to be clear, thank you again very much. And just to be clear, so for environmental issues hadn't really occurred to me, and what had occurred to me was competing economic uses of the water, but it sounds like if it's in winter and spring, maybe there wouldn't be any obvious one without going through lots of bureaucratic hoops, and that's valuable information, but information about both of those interests. The other interest that that I think too often gets lost in the crossfire between beneficial economic use and environmental preservation is sort of future water needs, right? You know, what's Umatilla County, what's the state of Oregon going to need 40 years from now, and to the extent this has any impact on that as we go forward, information on that would be really helpful, but your expertise is really valuable.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Martha and Representative Jensen. Thank you for bringing the bill forward, and we'll work together and see if we can get it done.
Good. Thank you, Chair Cannon and members of the committee, and I think from the discussion and the questions you've had, you will recognize that I was well counseled to have someone here to handle the technicalities of this, which seem to be much greater than, as you have been pointing out, than we might have thought when we looked at a simple little project and a little irrigation ditch coming off the Umatilla River. So thank you very much.
And you're back to Ways and Means now to figure out how to spend all the money that the state
has. Yeah, now that I've got all the money out of this committee that it's possible to get, why we'll go back and spend it real quickly before somebody comes along and takes it.
All right. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you,
Ms. Beagle. With that, we will, anybody else to testify on House Bill 3602? Nobody else signed up. I'll close the public hearing on 3602 and open a public hearing on, this is a public hearing?
Yes.
On LC 99. This is a potential committee bill. Members, under our rules, my understanding is that we will have the opportunity to introduce this as a bill in the first days of our February session. At this point, it remains an LC draft. We've had some discussion of this in the past. There are a few folks we've finally shaken the woodwork enough to get some folks signed up to testify on exempt wells and our proposal here. Let's begin with Brenda Bateman and Doug Woodcock from the Water Resources Department.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator for the Water Resources Department. And with me this morning, we have Doug Woodcock, who is our groundwater chief. I'd like to turn over our testimony to him.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Doug Woodcock, groundwater manager for Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to come and discuss the exempt use legislative concept. This particular concept, which we have discussed previously, makes several modifications to 537-545, which is the exempt use statute. And that particular statute allows for an exemption of groundwater for particular uses, such as domestic and stock watering and some commercial industrial uses. This particular legislative concept makes some amendments to that, and there are five of them, I believe, that five proposed changes to that. First of all, would carve out the single domestic exemption from what was originally the single and group domestic exemption up to 15,000 gallons a day. Secondly, it would reduce the allowed exemption under the single domestic exemption down to 5,000 gallons per day. Thirdly, it would take the exemption for half-acre non-commercial lawn and garden and fold that into the existing exemptions so that within the single domestic exemption for 5,000 gallons a day, that would also include lawn and non-commercial garden watering up to a half an acre, within that 5,000 gallons. And then lastly, it would authorize the Water Resources Commission to require a permit of users who wish to use exempt uses in groundwater restricted areas. These are areas that have been defined by the commission as either being groundwater limited or withdrawal areas or critical groundwater areas. Currently, most of those areas allow for exempt uses, and that was the commission's intent. But there are some areas that warrant a little finer look where we have some problems and some exempt use development could be exacerbating that. So in those areas, this would provide the commission the authority to require a permit review and prior to the use of that exemption. So with that, I will open it for questions.
Great, and I should make sure it's clear to the committee that the department has indicated that they are neutral on this bill and are here to provide sort of your expertise and background, and we should take advantage of that. So questions for the department. Representative Boone.
I have a couple. How do you determine and how will you monitor this kind of use in, for example, people with larger yards, and they may not water the whole lawn or something like that, but they have gardens or a food garden or whatever, and maybe their food garden's quarter or a half acre. Are they precluded from watering their yard then, or their plants and things like that? Or do you add up all the, I know this is kind of long and convoluted, but do you add up and measure the size of the gardens around the house, or how that, I'm just curious how that's going to be determined, the half acre piece, and how it will be monitored.
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, that is exactly correct. When the department receives a complaint that there is excessive watering, for instance, the water master then will investigate, and in that there is a look to see whether water is being used within the terms of the permit or the exemption. In this case, it would be an exemption, and that exemption would allow watering up to one half acre. So those areas would be measured off to see whether that use would be within the half acre. Under this legislative concept, that would also require a look to see whether the use would be under 5,000 gallons a day. If it's apparent that, yes, this looks very reasonable, then it would in all likelihood drop there. If it is questionable, then there may be a requirement to do some metering to see that the use is within the 5,000 gallons a day.
Then, again, the same kind of, then you answered my, one of them already, but what? How are golf courses affected then?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, a golf course would be considered a commercial establishment, so they would be allowed under this legislative concept, would be allowed 5,000 gallons per day, which would include up to one half acre of non-commercial lawn and garden.
And the final question, final follow-up, what is a downhole heat exchanger or exchange?
Representative Boone, a downhole heat exchanger is a type of heat exchange that's done with a heat pump for heating and cooling, and it just involves a looping of piping that goes down the well and then may extend actually out into the yard, all buried. But the concept there is that it's a closed-loop system that has some sort of a fluid. Traditionally, like an ethylene glycol might be used, you know, an antifreeze type of thing that would exchange heat, and then that would be run through the heat pump and used to heat and cool. But those are largely non-consumptive. Essentially, they are non-consumptive.
And a final?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is truly final. Can you give me some sort of sense of how much 5,000 gallons
right.
is?
Right.
Yeah. Like if you turned on your hose, how long would it run? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Very good question, Representative Boone. So if you ran your well for 1 gallon a minute all day long, that would be 1,440 gallons, which would be 1,440 minutes. Okay, so you're looking at roughly, 5 gallons a minute type of thing. Less than 5 gallons a minute, 3, something. I don't know what it is right offhand, and I'm not firing on all cylinders because I have a good cold this morning, so forgive me.
Thank you.
Other questions for the department? Representative Smith.
I wanted to just get a repeat of that one. You said 1,440. Give it again. Give me that again. It gets as close as a, you know, seven-year-old can understand.
Representative Smith, there's 1,440 minutes in a day.
Yeah.
So 1 gallon a minute would be 1,440 gallons per day, right? Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So I'm mixing my per days and per minutes here.
Yeah.
Thank you. So 5,000 gallons a day. Looking at my conversion here, so 1 gallon a minute is I'm sorry, it's 86,000. I'm floundering here.
We can take it. We can take it offline. The committee is not meant to be a math quiz.
I'm sorry.
But if we can get some of the you know, water use stuff, mm-hmm. is just hard to. We deal with these big numbers, and it's, you know, worse than Ways and Means. And so I think her question is a great question. If before February we can just
may
that
I
question.
Allow you?
Sure, but just if somebody turned on their hose. Right? How long would it take for them to get up to 5,000 gallons? It's a really interesting question.
Oops. Thank you for indulging me here.
At a reasonable water pressure.
At a reasonable water pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Squiddy is actually a math quiz.
Apparently.
Yes, it really is.
But it's
really
an open
is.
Book.
Yeah.
So let's go. I'm sorry.
While he's working that out, Representative Benz, do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the 15,000 versus the 5,000 doesn't make a whole bunch of difference if you don't have a means of regulating. And I note that a part of the proposal is to reinstate the authority to authorize but not oblige the commission to require permits for what are currently exempt use wells located in Oregon's groundwater administrative areas, and I guess that means, I guess I need to know what that administrative area means. Yeah, that's one thing. The second is, if this statute is enacted, then what does the department intend to do with this new 5,000-gallon standard? And that's different from what you're currently doing with the 15,000-gallon standard.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to your first question about the administrative areas, we have three types of areas that are defined in statute, and so these are areas that are limited, critical, and withdrawn, and they really increase in, I guess you'd call it severity, in terms of the restrictions that are put on them for current and or new users of water. And this is because of the science that we have developed at the department that shows declining water levels. And so that's what they are based on. But in terms of the change from the 15,000 to the 5,000, as Doug had mentioned before, because of the resources we have at the department, much of what we do is response, is complaint driven to questions and calls that folks are making. And so we would continue to operate under that type of a system. But when we're looking at the 5,000, oftentimes we'll need to come in and bring measurement with us, because as you say, it's very hard to determine the volume of water that's being used without a measurement device in place. And so in that sense, operating the system or managing the system would remain very much the same as it does today. We would respond to a call, and we would need to figure out a way to measure what's coming from that well and being used. Yeah. You want to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to know how big a deal this is, because to this point, I don't know how often the department, if ever, has checked to see if someone was exceeding the 15,000 gallon limit. And I'm just trying to get at whether or not, if we adopt this law, the department's going to suddenly start doing something different. Or why? The real question is, why are we doing it? Mm-hmm. That's the real question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our water masters respond to calls for assistance all the time. And So we would continue to do that. What we often find is that actually maintenance or construction type of question that it turns out to be at the end of the day, and not hitting against the maximum usage. For a daily household use inside, I think we had some numbers that we brought with us. Typically you see 200 to 400 gallons per day for inside domestic use, and then maybe another 2,000 gallons per day or 3,000 when you add the external use to it. And so for most households, this is going to have little practical effect. I think what it does is give our department and our water masters some very real and tangible tools to use as part of their management duties.
Thank you.
Doug, did you want to?
Oh, Mr. Chair, again, sorry for the confusion there. I had it right the first time. It's 3.5 gallons a minute running all day long will get you in that 5,000 gallons a day. So, if you can picture a one-gallon bucket and how quickly you can fill that up just at your tap fills up pretty quickly. Well, that's, if you imagine filling that up three times in a minute, that's the kind of rate that you would be looking at running all day long to get at the 5,000 gallons a day.
Great. Thanks very much. Seeing nothing further, let's we have four other people signed up to testify. I'll bring you up two at a time. So let's start with Peggy Lynch and Sean Jillians.
Yeah. Can we get along? Good morning. Chair Cannon and members of the committee, I'm Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. And last session I shared with you Water in Oregon, Not a Drop to Waste report that the League did as a study. Basically, it was a discussion of the various water laws for water quantity and quality in Oregon. We also serve on the Drinking Water Advisory Committee, so water is of big interest to our members. In 2007, we supported House Bill 2859, which actually had a limit of 1,000 gallons instead of 5,000. We certainly support this legislation. It is a modest bill. Frankly, you have heard the fact that in urban areas, around 100 to 150 gallons is what's used. In Benton County, we have a couple of ways of doing some kinds of measurements in that we have some public water systems, one for a very small urban type subdivision, which is about 125 gallons a day. The suburban larger lot public water system uses about 500 gallons a day. So 5,000 is really greater than most people would ever need. So having the tool to at least say there's a real problem here, you are actually using more groundwater than is really needed, I think is an acceptable tool. And it is only complaint-driven. We simply do not have another system. If anyone has seen the recent coverage in the freeze in Florida, you might have seen the big sinkholes that all of a sudden showed up in a number of places. And if you didn't see it, it was dramatic. And as I understand it, the reason for those huge sinkholes was the extreme and immediate demand of the orchardists who needed to cover their crops to save the citrus. And so it really was a sinkhole caused by groundwater depletion, a quick groundwater depletion. Groundwater in Oregon is an unknown quantity. We certainly know in some areas that we have limited groundwater. It is of serious concern to many Oregonians. So we certainly support this bill and are hopeful that it will move forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Peggy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Should just put on the record right now, Mr. Chair, I went to law school so I wouldn't have to do math, so perhaps I should just sit at the back of the room. But we are here unfortunately, in opposition to the bill. And I think you've heard a lot about the 5,000 gallons a day. I'm going to touch more on the second half of the bill, which is the permitting requirement in limited areas. We do have concern with that. As most of the committee is aware, we spent much of 2008 in a work group addressing domestic wells. And we had a lot of great presentations by the department and other folks. And one of the things that stuck out to me the most was the time that's required to actually get a permit. And the department at their current levels at that time said it took 9 months to get a permit. And that just really stuck in my head, because if we're talking about a development of a single house in a groundwater limited area, an additional 9 months to wait to perhaps get your permit. I'll channel Dave Honeycutt for a second here, Mr. Chair, which is, I think we have some Measure 49 implications with that as well, because these folks who have been in the express lane and who have gotten their rights to develop three properties perhaps are not going to be able to develop their property if they're not granted the permit. In addition, they have that additional 9-month lag when they've already been in the line for a couple of years on 49 claims. So those would be our concerns with that second half of the bill. I think the 5,000-gallon discussion we could have all day, Mr. Chair, but our real concern is the permit language. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
So if we were dealing only with the first half of the bill, you'd be willing to discuss it all day, wouldn't be opposed? Is that?
I can't say necessarily that we would happily go along, Mr. Chair, but that might get me no longer sitting here for very other reasons. But I think it is a discussion worth having. I think honestly, you did a better job in this draft as far as you put group in a separate category rather than lumping everyone in there. I think that's a start, but I think more discussions would need to be had on the actual gallon limit per day.
I'd be very interested in having that discussion if we, you know, as we continue to consider moving this forward, would love to do so with your, if not support, at least willingness to accede to some reduction in the 15,000. So let us know. Other questions for this panel?
So, Mr. Chair, really quickly, I just want to make sure that I also put on the record, we support the concept of the permitting in the groundwater administrative areas. That is the big issue that people in Oregon are complaining about, are concerned about, is that, in fact, we have more and more of those showing up around the state, although the Water Resources Department has not yet taken action. We are seeing that those, we may see more of those than are in the crusty, dusty map that we have today related to those areas. And it's a very serious problem on both sides of the Cascades.
Thanks, Peyton. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John Chandler, Richard Kosison. Or just Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning. I think that can go to Sue.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosison, Water for Life. I'm going to surprise everybody by suggesting perhaps that the bill draft and the proposal before you is a little bit premature. One, in terms of exempt uses, let's keep in mind. Exempt uses in terms of total use of water in the state of Oregon represent less than 1% of water use demand. In terms specifically of groundwater, they're probably somewhere estimated at 6 to 7 to 8% of groundwater use demand. Also keep in mind that the domestic wells, most of that water used domestically is returned to the aquifer. So if you used a high number of 7% of total groundwater use in the state of Oregon, 50% return, you're talking about 3% of water use in the state of Oregon. If it's total water use, it's less than 1%. I think Representative Boone's question and Representative Bence's inquiry began to address the issue in terms of we have a standard of 15,000 gallons a day that's been in statute, providing flexibility for different settings. we artificially lower that to 5,000 or 2,500 or 1,000? And how do you enforce that ultimately, and how does it actually work? I think the enforcement question is prevalent, but I think prior to the enforcement question, there's a question also of what problem are we trying to specifically address? In terms of the premature nature of the legislation, I would encourage the committee to take a look at Senate Bill 788, passed last session, which set up a registration system. That's been in effect. I think there was some discussion about when that bill was effective, but I think it became effective on or around July 1, so it's been in effect literally 6 months. Let's kind of take a look at the efficacy of those efforts, if they are fruitful or not. I would also suggest that in terms of regulatory authority, in terms of the designation of critical groundwater areas, groundwater limited areas, ability for the department to withdraw certain areas for complete withdrawals, the department maintains the existing statutory authority. If you take a look at the critical groundwater areas and the statutes there, the department has the ability to any one or more provisions making such additional requirements as necessary to protect the public welfare, health, safety in accordance with the intent and purposes and requirements of 537.505 to 537.795, which deals with groundwater in the state of Oregon. So in terms of enforcement tools, does the department maintain those? And I believe the answer to that is yes. Mr. Jillians referenced a consensus group that was conducted throughout 2009. Mr. Chandler, to my right, was a member of that, and I think basically after a year, the consensus reached was that we were not going to reach consensus. But it was a very interesting exercise. In terms of domestic groundwater use, I would suggest that there is a better avenue, and that is to look at the conservation programs. The conservation programs could be mirrored. Those conservation programs found in, I think it's 537.455, but the concept was to incentivize conservation, and I think that would be a sound use. But if you take a look at specifically domestic use, the majority of domestic use that we commonly refer to it is not inside the house but outside the house. An incentive for individuals with a single domestic use well to conserve, to install drip systems, to install new irrigation systems could save probably, I think good estimates would be a quarter to upwards of half their outside irrigation use. I think that would be a much more productive avenue for everybody involved. The last thing I would mention, I think the committee, if they pursue this, should take a specific look at your structure of your group domestic purposes in terms of ultimate impact. You could have, and in the valley, I think there are certain settings with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 homes with one single well. It's been in statute, but you're suggesting that the outside usage is limited to 1/2 acre in total for 5 homes or 6 homes or 7 homes. And I think the committee, in terms of looking down the road, should look at some flexibility with that rather than maintain the system with one well serving 4, 5, or 6 homes. I think what we provide is an avenue where we would have the 4, 5, 6 homes with individual wells, which I think is counter to the policy direction that you want to go. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage the committee to take a breath and not move forward on this concept. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard, and I appreciate your last comment. It's something I hadn't noticed on the when it splits single and group. It still draws the one-half acre definition into group. We'd have to consider the implications of that because, as you suggest, a group setting might very reasonably have more than a half an acre that it's watering. So I think that's worth taking a look at. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I'm watching bills in two different committees today, so hopefully my comments won't be overly duplicative of what you've already heard. We have been working, as Mr. Jillian's, I'm sure, told you on the consensus group. Mr. Kosasan mentioned 788 last session. Those are efforts that have been going on for some time on this issue of groundwater, particularly residential rural groundwater uses. Nothing that we came up with, and there wasn't a consensus reach, but there's a lot of good discussions on the consensus group, starting with the fact that we aren't entirely sure, we don't have enough data yet to figure out what exactly is the situation with regard to groundwater usage. In my mind, there's no compelling reason for this bill now, particularly given those, and certainly less than there was before. We already have the tools in place from 788. It's been given 6 months to work. We ought to at least let that run for a while to see how that produces. We have the starting point of a good conversation under the consensus process. Brought a lot of people into the room sitting around a table that hadn't been having those conversations before. Frankly, it seems to me this whole issue has, there's two components that it might be trying to address. One is a concern about depleting critical groundwater, and I don't mean critical, important groundwater resources. Absolutely a good concern in certain parts of the state. The problem is what we're doing here with this bill, limit the withdrawal, that's the numerator of the equation. It's not. We still don't know what the denominator is. And so if you're 15,000 gallons a day, if there's a 30,000-gallon tank below the surface, that's a big deal. If there's an ocean below the surface, it has no effect at all. And we simply don't know in certain parts of the state where the aquifers are getting depleted, where there's problems with interference with surface water and that sort of thing. We've tried, and on our consensus group, and certainly the home builders and realtors, Mr. Kosasan's clients, have tried over the years to empower the Department of Water Resources to give them additional fees, as we agreed to last session, to give them additional resources, give them additional legislative direction to go off and figure out to the best ability they can scientifically where the groundwater areas that are in trouble in Oregon are, and then to start limiting the uses in those areas. But in my mind, there's no justification for limiting uses in parts of the state where there isn't a problem, which leads me to the second issue this bill might be trying to address, and that's the concern about rural land development generally, which I'd submit to you is really a land use issue, not a water issue. And using water regulation to address land use concerns is probably using the wrong tool for the task. I don't know that in some parts of Oregon where you still have rural land available for development, there's not that much of it to begin with, but in those areas, much of the most productive little hobby farms and farm-to-market sources and all that are coming on small acreages. I'm not sure there's a good public policy interest in limiting the amount of water they can use. All that being said, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kosasan makes a very good point. There's a lot of other things we could do to encourage conservation, even in areas where groundwater is plentiful. There's no reason to be profligate about it. You could give more education, get the extension service involved, make sure people know about drip systems, rain harvesting. We're fixing the building code, for example, on new construction to make it easier to use gray water for external uses. We could certainly do the same sort of thing for existing housing. We provide some programs and incentives for people to do that. There's a lot of ways to skin this particular cat. Simply going from one arbitrarily selected number to a lower arbitrarily selected number, I'm not sure what that gets us. And I would certainly be a mistake, win or lose on this issue, it'd be a mistake for anybody to think that by having done so, we've actually accomplished either of the objectives of trying to address real groundwater concerns or the rural development concerns to the extent that whichever one of those is driving this discussion. So we will certainly be willing to work on this issue with the legislature, with the agency, with the interest groups. I think it's an important one. I don't want to make light of the fact we've said publicly many times if there's a groundwater concern, a problem area, there should not be development allowed, there should not be withdrawals allowed. That's not where we're at, though. We're talking about a hypothetical situation and applying a very broad fix to it. We would not be supportive, in other words, of this particular legislation. We would be supportive of continuing to discuss the problem. Be glad to take any questions.
Doesn't the second half of this bill get at that issue related to the groundwater limited areas, the part that authorizes the department to require a permit in areas where groundwater is limited?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to defer to. I've been active on this issue, but I would not want to take a quiz on the administrative authority and requirements of the department. I defer to people like Mr. Kosasan and the department, frankly, as to whether or not that addresses the concern. I'm not trying to dodge, but I'm going to dodge.
Right, yeah. I mean, the bill, as or the LC draft, gives the commission the authority to adopt rules to implement and enforce permitting for groundwater limited, groundwater critical areas, and that would appear, for exempt uses in those areas, that would appear to get at your attention to those particular areas as opposed to a sort of broad.
Mr. Chairman, members, it may work. If you permit me just one observation, though. I'm not an expert on Oregon Water Resources Department regulations. There are other agencies that might speak to that or claim that status, not here. I will say, though, as a matter of having been around this building for a while, the department has a lot of authority. Now, whether this adds to it in important ways or not, I can't speak to that. But the department has a lot of authority. What the department has not had consistently, if you don't mind my saying this, is the support of this body, and not any of you individually necessarily or collectively, but in previous legislatures. There's probably no agency in the state, with the possible exception of LCDC, that gets batted around worse in the legislative process than Water Resources. That would, both budgetarily, administratively, and just flat getting bounced up and down during hearings. My personal belief is they have the authority for a lot of things that they don't dare do for fear of getting in trouble. So that, whether this would simply add one more thing that they're going to get slapped for or not, I'll defer to the agency and, again, to the folks that know their regs better than I. But I think that is, I think, is important for this committee and your colleagues, frankly. If this is going to be a point of significant state focus, to make sure that that doesn't evaporate once session ends and once the rulemaking starts, because, frankly, this is a very, water is probably the most controversial issue out there. And it's, this agency takes a lot of heat for trying to do its job over the years. Even when I disagreed with them, it's important that we know just add one more thing that they aren't going to be able to, practically speaking, won't be able to do.
The controversy of water is what makes this committee so exciting. And
Dear.
Thank you. But this is a subject we could discuss ad nauseum. I'm afraid we may be at risk of doing that today. So let's wrap this up. I appreciate both for bringing your expertise here and submitting this testimony. We'll carry on.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. With that, I will close the public hearing on LC 99 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3613. This is a bill I've introduced, committee. We've discussed this at our last meeting. It would reinstate the state's ban on offshore oil and natural gas drilling in our territorial sea. That ban expired on January 3rd of this year, so we are in the midst of what I hope is just a window in that prohibition, but that will depend on the outcome of our discussions and our work on 3613. We have a number of folks here to testify. I have a letter that, Sue, you could pass out now to members of the committee from a variety of groups, a letter that expresses support for this position, for this bill. And we're going to hear from six or seven folks today. Let's begin with Terry Thompson, Jim Ayers, and we'll have Mr. Bailey. Bob Bailey, if you'd come up as well, join this panel.
How are you? So shall I defer to you?
What's the matter?
Oh, no, no. Okay. Anybody else? Was there one other? My name's Terry Thompson. I'm Lincoln County Commissioner. And being a Lincoln County Commissioner, I represent a lot of interest in the ocean. We land about $35 million worth of fish a year locally, but our total value to our county is about $100 million, with the two ports of Depot Bay and Newport being our major ports. And, of course, we feel we have the most spectacular coastline on the whole West Coast, and as far as I'm concerned, with maybe the exception of Alaska, the most
spectacular coastline in the United States. And it's up to people's opinion whether we have it or Alaska has it. We're a lot more easier to get at. And consequently, we have a major tourist industry there that depends on keeping a beautiful coastline. This bill does something that is unusual in that the environmentalists in the fishing industry seem to have pretty good support. Now, I won't say every person on the coast is supportive of it, but when I go out and talk to the people that I know, they think it's keeping a ban on oil rigs, at least on a temporary basis into the future, makes good sense. We've seen what other places in the world have done, and we think that Oregon has a better policy. The policy of the state of Oregon is that renewable resources are more important than non-renewable resources. And that's been a policy that's been established, I guess, since we've started to talk about ocean management. And that's the key policy here. I think we need to be consistent in that word, especially in light of the complications of spatial planning that's going on in the ocean now. The federal government is now in an effort, because partly by wind farms and other renewable resources, to start to try to divide the ocean up and create fences. And I think it's important that we keep that consistent policy in the state of Oregon at this point of saying, look, renewable resources is our priority in this state. And I want Washington, D.C. to hear that. And by creating that ban, I think you're restating it again, that this renewable resources is Oregon's number one priority for ocean management. The one thing that I do like here is you still have an emergency clause. In case of a national emergency, the governor can declare the area and say, okay, you can come in and get it if it's absolutely essential to health and welfare of the United States. But so far, I think that this looks like a reasonable decision. Some people feel that it needs to be revisited in 20 or 25 years. Other people feel that it should go on forever. But I appreciate the bill coming forward.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Thompson, for making the trip and for your advocacy on this issue and helping keep us abreast of folks on the coast. Thank you. Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Bailey. I manage the Coastal Division in the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's been my good fortune and a very interesting ride to be involved in this issue for over 25 years, off and on. So I provided, and I want to commend Commissioner Thompson. He and I have gone round and round on lots of things, but this is one thing I think we really agree on for the basic fundamental reasons that he stated. Oregon's priority is, and has been since 1977 in Goal 19, the preference for use of renewable resources over non-renewable. And in my years of working on this issue, dealing with the federal government and the offshore oil and gas lease sale program of the Department of the Interior, it was always difficult to make the case that Oregon had concerns about the federal leasing program for offshore oil and gas if we had not taken the same steps within state waters. So the department supports this bill and its intended outcome. I think it's one of those things that, in some respects, a no-brainer. I think we've moved into a new era, as Commissioner Thompson said, looking at the use of renewable energy resources from the ocean. In fact, we'll be talking about that later this morning. And the era of even contemplating offshore oil and gas development in this bountiful and productive and scenic area off our coast is something I think most Oregonians are very concerned about and opposed to. Just FYI, I've provided to you a little visual aid here. The map that I've shown to you just indicates the area off the coast. The little gray strip along the ribbon along the coast is the 3-mile territorial sea. Some places it expands because of rocks and islands. And then on beyond that is an area, the Oregon Ocean Stewardship Area, that is asserted in Goal 19. It's an area that we assert we have an interest in the conservation and stewardship of ocean resources. We don't claim to own them. But I want, and that's the area that would be available potentially for federal offshore oil and gas leasing. The area that it, that this moratorium would cover is the 3 mile territorial sea, as indicated on the map. The other visual aid is just a timeline of some of the events that have happened in the past in terms of the federal leasing moratoriums and the original moratorium in state waters that occurred between 1991 and 95, and its relationship to some of the planning events that we've been working on over the years on ocean planning. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, but we're in support of the bill, and I commend you for it.
Thank you very much. Jim, you want to add your thoughts?
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I didn't want to interrupt you. Good to see you. I didn't want to interrupt the other speakers. Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Ayers. I'm Vice President of Oceana. It's an international conservation organization dedicated to protecting the oceans. With me today is Sarah Winter Whelan from our office here in Oregon. As a matter of interest, if perhaps not relevance, I lived in Oregon for 10 years after serving the United States Marine Corps and did my master's degree at the University of Oregon while raising cattle up in Sandy, Oregon. So many of the issues you talked about earlier I'm pretty familiar with. Prior to joining Oceana, I was chief of staff for Governor Tony Knowles in Alaska for 7 years. And prior to that, I was the executive of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trust and was responsible for the final cleanup and restoration of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And let there be no doubt, there were thousands of marine mammals, hundreds of thousands of birds, and millions of fish killed as a result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Communities in the state of Alaska and this nation suffered, and there are lingering effects today. Oregon Territorial Sea, like Prince William Sound and Alaska waters, are teeming with wildlife, provide oxygen that we breathe, food that we eat. And let me also mention that they are aesthetic and spiritual nourishment that we need to make us whole. Healthy Oregon ocean ecosystems are also an economic engine, and as Bob mentioned, are sustainable and renewable resources for our economic engines here in Oregon. They provide recreation, commercial fishing, they substantiate the visitors industry, and also provide opportunities for people throughout the state for economic opportunities and recreational pleasure. I'll mention also that there are energy resources, renewable and sustainable, in the same territorial sea that we're discussing today. House Bill 3613, along with the recently passed House Bill 3013, initiated a process for both identifying important ecological areas and establishing marine reserves, are indications that you are becoming a leader in a nation that struggles and is desperate for stewardship and seeking a path of sustainable and renewable energy. This move to stewardship is critical, and we know it's tough given the proclamations and declarations that there are offshore drilling opportunities, and they are simple engineering feats. And that's the point I want to make with you, is that the point that oil development is focused in many of the discussions I saw in some of the previous testimony about this issue are surrounded or based on an argument that these are simple engineering feats. Frequently, we forget and we ignore the fact that this is a complex marine ecosystem in which this engineering feat is going to take place, and the consequences are severe and significantly different than onshore drilling engineering feat. I can't overemphasize the fact that marine ecology, we now know, is a developing science with new fundamental discoveries on a regular basis, and that science of oil pollution effects, despite the declarations to the contrary, is still in its infancy. I have an example of that very issue with regard to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which even today they're finding the oil deposits in the mid-intertidal zone in Prince William Sound. And let me tell you that both the oil companies and scientists had speculated that the residue of that oil would be in the upper tidal zone and a less dramatic and impact on the ecosystem. But because of residents' reports, there was an independent study of NOAA by Dr. Jeffrey Short. And in that independent, rigorous, quantitative study that involved no assumptions about where the beach oil might be found or what the impacts might be, the study showed that most of the remaining oil was in the more biologically productive mid-tidal portion of the beach. My point here is that over the last 20 years, scientists have proven false, similar, naive assumptions regarding the way in which oil components exert their toxic effects and the identities of many of the compounds that are known to be toxic, and even the efficacy of the response and mitigation technology, which we are often led to believe are in fact able to respond. Each time one of the assumptions is proven incorrect, it reinforces the fact that there's a great deal we do not know about these issues. I've provided a bibliography with my testimony to substantiate my testimony outside of my personal life. But let me say in closing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we strongly support 3613. I do so as a person who lives and works in Oregon, although my home is in Juneau, Alaska. I fish here frequently and just finished a float on the Rogue River. I spend a lot of time here, as does my family and my staff. In any event, it's clear there are prudent and sustainable energy opportunities. In addition, I have a map that was recently supplied by Secretary Salazar during a presentation in Alaska about energy on the West Coast. The rating by the Department of Energy, the United States Department of Energy Research Laboratory, has Northern California and Southern Oregon as a high to superb rating of wind energy opportunities that far surpass the risks that are involved in terms of ability to produce energy with low risk to the marine environment. There's absolutely no justification for short-term economic gain compared to the overwhelming, irreversible risk of oil and gas development in Oregon's territorial sea. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Harris, for making the trip and sharing your experience with us today. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you. Thank you again for the dinner at Rogue Brewery in 2002. I'm older now. What do we know about other areas in the United States that do allow offshore drilling and what's happened to those areas? And I ask that in a more general way than is probably helpful, but just so we understand it. And one of the reasons on my mind was my wife and I went to Southern California. We stayed in Laguna, and then we drove up to up through Malibu, et cetera. We passed Long Beach. And the coastal areas, I don't mean off the shore, I mean on the shore, are very different. And it did seem there was sort of a chicken and egg thing, right? If you go to Laguna and Malibu, you don't see oil rigs. If you go to Long Beach and the places that, you know, suffer from higher crime, et cetera, you do see oil rigs. And I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg, but you guys might have a better idea of what happens onshore when we build offshore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I'll take a little shot at that. I don't know if I'd make that exact comparison, but I do know that on the California coast and the Gulf Coast, a number of the effects are more in the, it's not so much even the occurrence of oil on the beaches, although that can happen and does happen. It's the effects in port communities, on estuaries, it's the back of facilities, it's displacing fishermen from fishing grounds, it's really, the industry can become dominant in an area, and we've got very small ports on the coast. The industry can become dominant in onshore facilities, the oil tank farms, the pipelines, the backup facilities. There are other effects that can go on out in the marine environment from just the actual day-to-day operations, the drilling muds and cuttings, the fluids that are produced. I think the experience is such that, to go a little more personally on this, I think there's a degradation of the total experience that comes from industrializing the coast to that degree. The Oregon coast has had a timber industry that was an indigenous industry. It had its own issues, but at least it was our industry and fit. The oil industry and its effects are sort of corrosive at some sort of level that, in my view, and I think the view of many others, alters the kind of the economic and social character of the communities that it's in. So, say nothing of being able to look offshore and see a line of rigs out there at night. And you know, most of us are, as you said, are after it's. There's a healing in the soul of our ocean and coastal experience, and industrialization with oil rigs is, I think, probably one of the more corrosive effects.
Mr. Chairman, if I can add a couple comments Bob made there, Representative Smith. One of the things that I did not emphasize, although let me assure you that my testimony was far longer than my diatribe there, which I have submitted to you in writing, with a bibliography. One of the things that we now know in Alaska is that there was a lot we didn't know. And one of the things that is still being discovered in Prince William Sound and all the way out the Aleutian Chain is that there are lingering effects. Sea otters are one of the best examples you may or may not have heard of, that continues not to recover as a result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in March of 1989. The other toxic effects are those that we're just now becoming aware of and learning to understand. In Alaska, the North Star project was determined, it's an offshore project, but it is a island-like offshore project, and there was considerable research, and there is today, about the emphasis on, again, as Bob just mentioned, keeping drilling muds and other fluids that were previously thought to have no impact, now seen years later as having lingering impacts. And I'll just mention one other. It's in the bibliography. The Gulf is the best place to look at with regard to your references, Representative Smith, and that is that the Gulf is continuing to find every day, well, I'll just say on a frequent basis, lingering and toxic, insidious effects of what was previously thought to be non-toxic impacts of waste and discharge. I think the person's name's Rombley. Nancy Rombley is, Dr. Rombley is probably the foremost scientist now there.
Let me answer this really quick. Oregon has a reputation for having a clean environment. It helps in all of our agriculture industries, not just fisheries or not just coastal people. We have a reputation around the world. I know in Japan, when you say you're from Oregon, oh, that's really clean. That's good food. And we sell a lot of food out of Oregon. If we were to bring the oil industry in here, we'd taint the perception by the rest of the world of something that we've built up over years. And that's worth a lot to this state.
Thank you. Representative Boone, and then I know we have a couple of people on tight timelines who will need to get up here. So, Representative Boone.
Just a really quick question. Back in the 90s, I remember Senator at the time Bradbury's bill, and I was on the Ocean Task Force. I met Bob, and we were told, I believe it was, there was three days of supply for the U.S. out there, and I know things change and stuff. Does anybody have numbers on what is predicted to be out there? I mean, I would think that there would have to be some knowledge of that before anybody would even be interested in doing it.
I'll take one shot and let the experts take their shot. You know, to give you a number of days, you've got to remember, we're talking oil and gas. We have gas in the form of hydrates in deep water that someday we may be able to harvest. The technology isn't there. I don't think anybody understands that, but we're trying to lay new science in areas in the way of a fiber optic cable to understand that area of the ocean better, and maybe we can learn how fast these hydrates rebuild. That may be a different source, but I think you're probably, at least I've heard the same number you have, that as far as petroleum, we're looking at 3 days.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone. Yeah, it's something on that order. It's the industry is over the years has not really been attracted to the Pacific Northwest. The preliminary studies done in the late 60s, early 70s showed a geological conformation out there that is not, you know, hugely promising. Except as I believe I indicated previously to the committee, some of the structures on the north coast look like they'd be more gas, natural gas fields, such as at Mist, than oil. But again, most of these are in federal waters. There's very little of it in actual in state waters. But it's not a big quantity. If there were, I think they'd have been beaten down the door long before this.
Thank you very much. I have an estimate here of 15 days of oil and 20 days of natural gas. So relatively small. Thank you very much for your testimony. Jessica Hamilton, from the Governor's Office, I know you have a narrow window, and Mike, are you planning to come up as well? Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's actually Jessica Keys now, Representative Kent.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm a policy advisor in Governor Kulongoski's office, and thanks very much. I'm going to try not to cough, so I'm going to demonstrate by using this program. Thank you for the opportunity to express the governor's support for HB 3613. The governor is a strong advocate for protecting the Oregon coast from oil and gas development, both our state's territorial sea and the federal waters that lie beyond that approximate three-mile boundary. In September of 2006, Oregon joined Washington and California to launch a historic regional ocean pact demonstrating the governor's collective commitment to protecting the health of the West Coast and its ocean and coastal ecosystems and the economies that depend on them. And one of the first actions that Governors Kulongoski, Gregoire, and Schwarzenegger took was to send a clear message that in opposition of weakening any federal moratorium on oil and gas leasing off the West Coast, which existed at that time. And the governor stated then and continued to believe that the risks to the coast of new development are far greater than any potential benefits. And as you guys have alluded to, by the federal government's own analysis, it'll take decades for any new extraction of oil and gas from the West Coast outer continental shelf to have a meaningful impact on total production or price. And while the three governors do not support any new exploration of oil and gas on the West Coast, they do support sustainable and environmentally responsible renewable energy development. Governor Kulongoski personally shared this message with Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar in April of last year. He encouraged the Minerals Management Service and the Department of the Interior to continue to explore wave and other forms of renewable energy and forego any attempt to drill offshore here. So Governor Kulongoski is dedicated to working with the legislature and our congressional delegation to develop positive solutions to our energy needs that do not involve the unacceptable impacts of offshore drilling. Representative Cannon, thank you for introducing 3613 and striving to restore protections to Oregon's nearshore ocean from oil and gas exploration and development.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Yep.
Finally, we'll hear from Nancy Fitzpatrick, Nick Furman, and Peggy Lynch. And if there's anyone else to testify on this issue, make yourself known to Sue. And we will, members, be rehearing this in the first days of February and expecting to move it along quickly as early as Tuesday the 2nd, assuming we are permitted under our rules to work bills that soon. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Cannon and committee members. My name is Nancy Fitzpatrick, Administrator for the Oregon Salmon Commission and the Oregon Albacore Commission, which are industry-funded commodity commissions under the Oregon Department of Agriculture's Commodity Commission Program. I'm here representing the commercial ocean salmon and albacore fishing industries. Both the Salmon Commission and the Albacore Commission support House Bill 3613 to reinstate the Oregon's ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. As an industry, we're already facing curtailment of fishing opportunities within the territorial sea with marine reserves and wave energy facilities. We do not want to have more of our valuable areas off limits to fishing and all other ocean uses. Our fishing industry is important economically and culturally to our state. Our fisheries support not only the fishing families, but also the coastal communities and the entire support infrastructure. We've seen evidence of this with the closures of our salmon seasons in the past few years and the impacts to our families, the gear stores, the ports, restaurants, fish buyers, and other related businesses. Our fishermen and the fishing industry along the entire Oregon coast depend on access to the grounds for our economic livelihoods. We do not want to see an interruption of traditional fishing practices in Oregon's territorial sea with offshore oil or gas drilling. We're concerned about its potential impacts on not only fishing, but also the entire Oregon coast and its communities. Therefore, we urge support of House Bill 3613. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission and also Chairman of the Southern Oregon Ocean Resource Coalition, also known as SOURCE. And if I could just digress from my comments just real briefly, early in my career in the early 80s, I had the opportunity to be a fishing vessel captain up in Alaska, operating a vessel out of Cordova and Prince William Sound. I can certainly attest to the devastating impact that the oil spill had to those communities, which have really never recovered from that episode. We have submitted written testimony in support of HB 3613, so I'll just keep my comments brief. I want to focus not necessarily on the potential environmental and ecological impacts of offshore oil drilling in the Oregon's territorial waters, but the economic impacts. Now, Oregon crabbers, if you haven't read in the paper, are enjoying a record season this year. They've landed in excess of 17 million pounds of Dungeness crab, worth $31 million to fishermen and $62 million to coastal economies in the first four weeks of the season. The important thing is that much, if not most, of that production has come inside of 3 miles in the territorial sea. Now, crabbers, the crab fishery is a real estate-dependent fishery. We use all of the soft, sandy bottom within the 363 miles of coastline in Oregon for about 8.5 months. Oil and gas leases would obviously render take some of that area, if not significant amounts of that area, out of production. As my as previous speakers have already attested to, and we're already poised to take significant amounts of the territorial sea set asides for marine reserves and wave energy development, we think it would be irresponsible to add additional pressures on economic drivers like the crab fishery by taking more of that land and water away. We appreciate the committee's efforts to see this legislation through, and we support it wholeheartedly.
I have to say, hearing about the success of the crab season so far makes me deeply envious, because I've been out twice in my dad's kayak with a trap and have not caught a single eligible
Dungeness. They caught them already.
In Neatarts Bay, so I'm glad you're doing well. I'm not.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I would recommend that the proper place to fish for crab is at the fishmongers, where they have wonderful crab right now, and I have been enjoying it immensely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Mr. Furman, did you bring samples?
The ethics law is ruined for me.
In fact, that is what I wrote on my notes here. The League was here when the legislation was first developed in the 90s, and we are here again to support the ongoing exemption for and the moratorium on oil and gas leases. It is the right thing to do. We have members all along our coast who do participate in the fishing and the crabbing and in the economy of our coast, and we believe that it's a very important factor. I frankly had written Dungeness crab down because I hadn't heard anybody else mention it, and I wanted to be sure that it was mentioned. You will hear more about our newly amended territorial sea plan later this later today, and you will hear the exciting things that are happening and the protections that we are providing for the multitude of uses that we will have on our Oregon coast. And that is the right direction for Oregon to go, and I encourage your support for House Bill 3616.
13. Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you.
Any questions? Great. Anyone else here on this issue today? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3613. And let's stand in recess until 10:30. come back into session. Thank you, Sue. And we have three topics scheduled for our informational component of the meeting, and we'll begin with Mr. Mike Carrier with an update on one of the issues about which we spent the most time in 2009. So looking forward to the update. We promised you that we'd be asking you for updates on this, and you promised us to come back and tell us what was going on in the Klamath, and appreciate you doing so today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, those are great memories. In fact, I got an award from my fellow staff for being probably the most assertive and most tutorial with freshman members of the legislature. It wasn't exactly a positive recognition. For the record, my name is Mike Carrier.
No idea what you're talking about.
Natural Resources Policy Director for Governor Kulongoski, and I'm here to update you today on the status of both the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement. I want to start with just a brief history. You well know that the Klamath Basin conflicts over competing claims on water, Endangered Species Act listings of suckerfish and salmonids came to a head in 2001 with the shutoff of water to irrigators. It was amplified again in 2002 with a significant die-off of thousands of adult salmon due to disease and poor water quality attributed to out-of-stream withdrawals. And the ongoing concerns and claims that affect the water, about the effect of water withdrawals and operation in particular of the four hydropower dams on water quality and fisheries in the Klamath River. So about 6 years ago, PacifiCorp began the process of relicensing with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, its four hydropower dams on the Klamath. Over two dozen parties intervened in the FERC proceeding. And the FERC licensing process suddenly became a forum for airing not just issues associated with the operation of the dams, but nearly all of the conflicts in the basin. And hence, with the support and encouragement of the company, PacifiCorp, the parties commenced a separate negotiation in an attempt to settle their issues with the understanding that once those issues were resolved, PacifiCorp would engage in them with a negotiation over the future of the dams. About that same time, we started to see significant curtailment of ocean salmon fishing, both recreational and commercial fishing, due to poor conditions and poor returns in the Klamath Basin and then subsequently in the Sacramento Basin. And that precipitated significant federal assistance to the fleets that were economically harmed by that and the associated industries, and a call by Governor Kulongoski and Governor Schwarzenegger for eventual removal of the four Klamath River dams as a key solution to restoring those salmon runs. In January 2008, the parties that had intervened and had commenced this negotiation announced that they had reached a comprehensive agreement on basin issues. It's called the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, and the settlement contains several major provisions. First, it's founded on the principle that resolution of the basin issues must include removal of the four dams. All the parties agreed that that would be one of the foundations of their agreement. It includes a program for fisheries restoration, fisheries reintroduction, and ongoing monitoring. It includes, and this is a very significant component, a water sharing agreement in which the irrigators and tribes in the basin agree that annual out-of-stream use would be reduced to benefit fish and water quality in exchange for assurances that the tribes and others will not make a call on water during the very driest years. And then there are certain regulatory assurances that are provided for in the agreement that support and buffer both the protection of fish efforts as well as the water-sharing agreement that had been reached. The KBRA, as we call it, the Basin Restoration Agreement, it includes provisions to financially assist county governments for lost property taxes associated with dam removal, as well as other potential economic impacts that might occur resulting from dam removal. The agreement seeks to provide affordable power for irrigators who had lost low-rate power through the termination of a contract or the expiration of a contract with PacifiCorp. And finally, it supports efforts by the tribal communities as they continue to build economic vitality for their members and sustainable fisheries. Now, shortly after that KBRA was announced, the states of Oregon, California, the Secretary of the Interior, who was then Dirk Kempthorne, and PacifiCorp began intense negotiations over the four hydropower dams. And in November of 2008, those four parties announced that they had reached a tentative agreement called the Agreement in Principle for Dam Removal that includes the following major provisions. First, the Secretary of the Interior agreed to undertake a comprehensive analysis of removal of the dams that fully evaluates the costs, risks, and liabilities of dam removal relative to the benefits, and to complete that analysis by March of 2012 to be followed with a secretarial determination regarding dam removal. Secondly, the states of Oregon and California agreed to contribute up to $450 million toward the cost of removal, with $200 million coming from a ratepayer surcharge over 10 years on PacifiCorp customers, and $250 million coming from general obligation bonds from the state of California. Next, if dam removal is undertaken, it would be done by a dam removal entity designated by the Secretary of the Interior, and it could be either a federal or a non-federal entity. Decommissioning and removal of the dams would include transfer of ownership and relief of liability for the company for any actions associated with dam removal. Another tenet of the agreement is that dam removal is targeted to begin in 2020, and between now and that time, the dams would be between now and the time the dams are transferred to a dam removal entity, the company would operate the dams under FERC annual licenses that include a number of measures to enhance fish habitat, support hatchery programs, address water quality problems, and fund ongoing monitoring. And finally, if it were determined that the dams would not be removed by the Secretary, PacifiCorp would return to the original FERC relicensing process, and any customer surcharges that have been collected would be returned to the customers or otherwise used for their benefit. Now, I want to talk to you, after giving you that history and background, about the current status of the agreements. From the very beginning, all the parties have been committed to two separate agreements, but two agreements that were indivisible. And in other words, if you support one, you support the other, and you work to implement both. So as one of the key elements of that, we presented to you, and you adopted, Senate Bill 76 in 2009, which authorizes the rate case for a surcharge on Oregon customers to build the decommissioning and removal fund. Since then, California has adopted legislation as part of a comprehensive water bond bill that would provide for an election this fall, authorizing $250 million for decommissioning removal of the Klamath River dams. We have since, as of September, completed the final version. What we had called the AIP is now the final version of the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement. We just last week completed the very, very final version of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, the agreement that was rolled out 2 years ago. And now all the parties have 30 days, in some limited cases 60 days, to obtain final authorization, depending on their governance structure, to sign those agreements. Governor Kulongoski, Governor Schwarzenegger, PacifiCorp, and the Secretary of the Interior are slated to sign the agreements in mid-February, with the remaining parties signing as soon as practicable thereafter. Federal legislation authorizing the Secretary to make his determination, and I must say we've been in debrief, Secretary Salazar, and he has embraced this agreement and the settlement as fully, in fact, even more fully than Secretary Kempthorne did. But federal legislation is being drafted now, and that legislation would authorize the Secretary to make this determination, identify and designate a dam removal entity. It provides for the immunity that we've agreed to provide the company when dams are removed. That legislation is in the process of being drafted and is planned for introduction in the Congress this year. The legislation also addresses the other federal authorizations that are needed to implement the larger Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. We've conducted several briefings to members of Congress and their staff, and will continue to do so through the coming months. And I have to tell you, Mr. Chair, as I participate in those briefings, it is a source of great pride for me to be able to say that Oregon not only had a key role in achieving these agreements, but that Oregon and its legislature, with leadership from this very committee, was the first to adopt legislation that authorizes and funds the implementation of the agreements. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carrier. Is the final agreement on the hydro piece public?
Yes, Mr. Chair, both agreements are public. They are available at a website that is edsheets.com, Klamath Docs HTML. And I can provide the committee administrator that website. The
both. I think the hydroelectric agreement is 60-some pages. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement is nearly 300 pages. They're very lengthy documents.
And does the final agreement on hydro depart in any significant respect from the agreement in principle?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Neither the Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement nor the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement depart in any significant ways from the draft AIP or the AIP that we presented to you a year ago or the KBRA tentative agreement that was rolled out 2 years ago. No significant changes.
Thank you. Representative Bernhardt.
California is facing gigantic fiscal challenges right now. Some states have had their bond ratings significantly reduced as a result of their improvident use of borrowing, mostly for the purpose of dealing with current budget expenditures, but I think related to other issues as well. Are there any concerns now about California's ability to fulfill its undertaking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, thank you for that question. There's always a concern, given California's precarious fiscal condition, about how that may intervene in an election next November for a $15 billion major water bond that within which the Klamath money is nested. However, the California legislature and Governor Schwarzenegger approved that legislation fully aware of the fiscal situation they were dealing with, both now and in the future. Did not take that lightly, I'm sure. One of the opportunities that California has is it is our expectation, in fact, it is a requirement of the agreements, that they have their funding authorized before the Secretary makes his determination in March of 2012. So if for some reason, and I'm just hypothesizing here.
You're answering my second question.
Right. If for some reason that is pulled back because of some serious financial problems in the state or reset for another election date, California actually has some cushion here. We need the rate surcharges to begin being collected as soon as possible from both states, but those are rate cases that will be made and charges to customers. The $250 that California is putting up really won't be needed until 2020, but isn't required in the agreements to be authorized until just before the Secretary's determination is made.
Thank you. Yes.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if I've said in the past how much we appreciate the hard work you've done on this, because even though I opposed it, I do appreciate the immense amount of work that's been done. You may have mentioned earlier the status of the Oregon PUC. Did you mention that in your report already? Because I think that our legislation was directed to authorize the PUC to go ahead with the hearing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, thank you for the question. I didn't mention it. The agreement provides for the presentation of a rate case by PacifiCorp to the Oregon PUC not sooner than 30 days after the agreements are executed. So we had hoped the agreements would be executed by now, but working with nearly 30 parties, you can understand, and their attorneys, you can understand, it doesn't move quite as fast as we'd hope. But we do have the agreements finished. We do have a tentative signing date set for mid-February. And we do expect that 30 days after that signing, the company will be prepared to present its rate case to the Oregon PUC, and the PUC will then begin operating under the direction of Senate Bill 76 that you adopted.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I believe the final agreement, which I studied, reflected a significant amount of federal money as part of the ultimate settlement. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was a lot. Where does that? When will that money be necessary? When will that funding have to be supplied by the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the hydroelectric settlement agreement is anticipated to be covered with the $450 million that the two states have committed. And that number was far in excess of what had last been estimated for dam decommissioning removal. And we even have a relief valve that if by 2012 or after that cost is higher than the $450, we have a meet and consult provision in the agreement to determine if we're going to go forward or suspend that and go back to dam relicensing. With regard to other federal funds that are needed to support this, there is an estimated total of about $970 million of investment in the Klamath Basin over 10 years to fully implement the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. About 90% of that is estimated to be in the form of fish habitat restoration and fish reintroduction and other measures to support and secure viable and sustainable fishery throughout the basin. And of that amount, it was estimated in the KBRA that it would be about $41 million in the first year, whatever the first year is, whether it's 2010 or 2011, and about $97 million a year of federal investment thereafter. And it was estimated by the parties, of which the federal government was one, that about 50% of that could come from the reprogramming or simply use of existing and authorized federal appropriations that are made in the basin now. So new appropriations from the Congress would be something on the order of $40 million a year over a 10-year period for the basin, again, with 90% of that being related to habitat work, water management work, fishery introduction.
Thank you for that detail, but I guess my question is, where are we in the line when it comes to actually getting the money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, you did ask me that question, and I didn't fully answer. What we did with the agreements is presented them to the Office of Management and Budget, and I've met with those folks, and they actually fit the stereotypes that we all have of them, with green eye shades and thick glasses, and they look at you with a lot of scrutiny as, why are you here with your hand out? But they're going through the agreements now and the appropriations that were identified that could either be used or the funds could be redirected, and truing those up, you know, according to their view of the world. And they're saying they think the number is closer to 40% of existing appropriations that could be used or reauthorized within the basin. The remainder of the funds, it would be up to the Secretary of the Interior or, in some cases, the Secretary of Commerce to include those in their annual appropriations request to the President. And part of the process that we're in right now is the White House has assigned the Secretary of the Interior, the Director of the Office of Management Budget, and the Director of the Council on Environmental Quality to serve as a task force to review the agreements and this fiscal issue and make a recommendation to the White House as to whether or not to go forward in requesting those appropriations. So we would expect, and we're, of course, expecting a positive determination and recommendation, a commitment from the White House, and for them to start including those in their 2011 appropriations requests.
Thank you. Representative Smith, and then...
Thanks. And thanks for your work, Mike. What do we know, if anything, more about, and I know about the thing we put in there, that there's that we anticipate no, we hope for no, and we require no, certainly, state liability over time beyond the additional charges by the ratepayers, et cetera. I know that was a set of questions, we might call it, that I had. And some of this overlays with what the feds might take on, you know, if in the unfortunate circumstance that cost ends up being worse than we thought. Do we know anything more about that? Not just about the content of agreements, but also about any cost estimates, et cetera. Do you know anything more about that set of issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, thank you for that. That was a major source of conversation during your deliberations last year. And what we've done is... responsive to the questions and concerns you all raised about, you know, how do we protect the state from being tagged with additional fiscal or other liabilities associated with dam removal, we really tightened up language in the hydroelectric settlement agreement to ensure that the state does not incur any additional liability. But with regard to identifying what those potential liabilities, notwithstanding the cost overruns, because we've handled that by just simply saying the states are capped at 450, that's all we're going to commit in these agreements.
Yeah.
If it goes over that, we'll meet and confer, but we make no guarantees or promises. But with regard to the other risks and liabilities that the states might have, we first of all believe that the states are protected as they always are in their regulatory authorities, because we're going to be issuing a number of permits for both the continued operation as well as the decommissioning removal, and the state does have some protection from liability regarding those actions. And secondly, the very purpose and the heart of the Secretary's determination and the studies that are going to be going on between now and March 2012 will be to fully identify and attempt to address all those costs, risks, and liabilities. So, you know, we haven't identified anything more than what we talked about a year ago, you know, such things as what's in that sediment above the dams, mm-hmm. what's the effect of releasing that sediment if it's released. We really haven't identified anything more, but I have to say that the Bureau of Reclamation is already undertaking the studies and the analysis to, you know, inform the Secretary's determination in March of 2012.
Thanks.
Paul? There were some not testimonial conversations about, well, the hope is that if X is really bad, and we don't know what X is, right, that the feds might step in and do something. It wouldn't merely be a matter of, you know, our small budget or, you know, having to live with something we don't want to live with or private stakeholders or whatever, but that the feds, do we have any more indicate now that we've had a, you know, Secretary of the Interior for a little longer, now that we've had a president for a little longer, do we have any more indications from them to, for the good or for the ill in that set of thinking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I think we do. We were dealing with an outgoing administration and negotiating the AIP, and we were surprised and pleased that they embraced this as fully as they did. It was even more gratifying to have Secretary Salazar personally meet with our group and even more fully embrace and commit to undertaking this agreement. And I had this conversation with the chair just before the committee meeting restarted. This has been the interesting thing to watch about the federal dynamic over the past few years is their increasing reluctance to engage in mutual problem solving and partnership on issues just like this. And it's because the federal government is losing certain capacities to reach out and help and make commitments for the long term domestically, which is really a concern to us for regions like the Klamath. So we've had to, you know, rather than maybe as 20, 30 years ago, we might have just gone right to the Congress and the White House and said, well, we've got some solutions here. It's going to require you making an investment, step up, and expecting them to do so. Now there's a lot more hand-holding, a lot more relationship building, and a lot more patience on our part to kind of bring members of the Congress and the White House along with an understanding that federal participation in this, while there's no commitment of federal resources on the hydroelectric removal side, which is where you're focused, the very act of the Secretary agreeing to undertake the study, agreeing to seek authorization from the Congress to oversee dam decommissioning and removal and assign an agent, clearly imbues in the federal government responsibilities that would include dealing with and solving problems associated with unforeseen going forward. It's just requiring more patience than I ever expected to have to make sure that they get there. And if you look at the history, I mean, the Secretary of Interior is not without experience here. There have been a number of dam removal projects that Interior has been involved with, and the best example is the Elwha Dam on the Olympic Peninsula, and they've been 16 years going through the environmental analysis and the permitting and the contracting to get that done. And then with the recent infusion of cash from the stimulus bill last spring, they're actually now going to undertake removal. So a Savage Rapids Dam by the Bureau of Reclamation was just successfully removed. There's enough history there that I think the Secretary knows he's going into it with his eyes wide open as to what his future liabilities and responsibilities are.
Thank you, Mr. Carrier. I should have realized that any discussion on the Klamath with you and this committee would last longer than whatever time I allotted for it in the agenda. I know that we could go on. And Representative Smith has another question.
No, I only had two questions.
Yeah. Oh, that was it. Okay.
Because we do have to move on. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, you'll recall that, you may recall that House Bill 2186, which came through this committee, included in its final version the creation of a Metropolitan Planning Organization Greenhouse Gas Emissions Task Force, and under the statute they are required to report to interim committees, including ours. And that's what they are here to do. So, Gail and Joan, you have a presentation. I think you're well practiced at giving it now.
This is the third time.
Third or fourth?
I'm Gail Ackerman, the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission.
I'm John Van Landingham. I'm chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. We're going to be brief, maybe hopefully briefer than we were twice yesterday. We're going to try to hit the key points, leave time for questions. You have a 40-page written report from the task force and a 7-page summary. We want to recognize that three legislators served on the task force, Representative Call and Representative Beyer, as well as Senator Dingfelder, and also recognize that poor Senator Representative Bentz and Boone heard this already. And we didn't satisfy Representative Bentz yesterday. I don't know whether we will today.
So I'm going to start off and just do a little bit of background. I think if you're talking about metropolitan planning organizations and greenhouse gas emissions, one thing that's important right up front is to understand why greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector are important and need to be addressed. And it really is that 34% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon are attributable to the transportation sector, with most of that coming from light vehicles. In other words, it's not the big freight trucks that are generating most of those emissions, it's light vehicles. So if we are going to meet our state greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, we've got to figure out how to do emission reductions from the transportation sector. With the legislative adoption of the renewable energy standard for the energy sector, they're clearly doing their part. That's the biggest part of the emissions is from the energy sector. So the question is now, what is the transportation sector going to do, which is the next biggest part? The next question beyond why are greenhouse gas emission reductions in the transportation sector important is what are metropolitan planning organizations and what do they have to do with this? And I think it's important for you as legislators to realize first that we have 6 metropolitan planning organizations in the state of Oregon. The metropolitan planning organizations are a creature of federal law, not state law. So even Metro, which is the one state statutory metropolitan planning organization that exists, it is designated through a federal process to be a metropolitan planning organization under the Surface Transportation Act. So every metropolitan statistical area of 50,000 people or more has to form a metropolitan planning organization and prepare a regional transportation fund plan if they want to receive federal transportation funds. So 5 of the 6 in Oregon are committees of local governments, cities, counties, transit districts, ODOT, sitting together to develop a regional transportation plan. And if you turn to page 3 of our written testimony, you'll see a table, and the table shows you that while every one of these MPOs serves as a forum for cooperative decision making among the many jurisdictions that deal with transportation, they are very different. If you just look at that table and you see Bend versus Portland on the left and right columns, the annual budget for Bend is $223,000 for transportation planning. The annual budget for Portland Metro is $10,993,000. Bend has 2.5 staff provided by the local council of governments, where Portland has 96. And you see Corvallis, Rogue Valley, Salem-Keizer, and Central Lane along that continuum. So the capacity of these regional planning organizations is very different. The final thing I'd like to note is that House Bill 2186 and the mandate to develop a process for adoption and implementation of plans by these metropolitan organizations ties directly to House Bill 2001, which the Jobs and Transportation Act, which required scenario planning in the Portland metro area and in the Central Lane Metropolitan Planning Organization. So they were required to do this. The two MPOs were required to do this in 2001. And our task force really focused on how are we going to approach this kind of planning in the other four MPOs, Corvallis, Salem-Keizer, Bend, and Rogue Valley. John?
HB 2186 required the task force to make a report to you all by the end of the 2009. So that's what this is. We met four times between October 15th and December 4th. We began by agreeing that we would act only by consensus, which we defined as minus one. So in essence, that meant that any two MPOs could block, and the MPOs tend to share their concerns. The non-metro MPOs share their concerns. They meet together. We reached consensus at our last meeting on December 4th. So this report represents a consensus report to you or agreement to you. In essence, it lays out a roadmap for how we go forward. It doesn't have any answers or solutions right now. One of the things it includes is scenario planning. Scenario planning is simply a term that describes planning for how development and transportation facilities might be done in the future to accommodate our growth and change over time, and allows us to evaluate results from different scenarios. We already do this with our land use planning and transportation planning. Now, we're talking now about doing it with more information, with more results. There were concerns by the MPOs that scenario planning is, there's too much emphasis here on scenario planning, and it's not the answer. We did this because HB 2186 requires us to do it, to evaluate scenario planning, so we've done what we were asked to do. Secondly, nationally, it's being done by other states. It is, we think, an effective tool to help on planning going forward. To help it with the MPOs, we agreed that we would treat the Central Lane as a pilot project to do some scenario planning with Central Lane and let the other MPOs see whether it helps in any way. Central Lane and Metro are required by HB 2001 to do something like this already anyway, and the departments are required to work with them to make that happen. And then finally, I would say that the plan itself includes quite a bit other than just scenario planning. We don't think that scenario planning by itself is the answer. We were also asked by the bill, 2186, to identify impediments, and that's in the report on pages 22 and 23. I want to highlight three of those. The first is the obvious one, fiscal. Some of these things are going to cost money, both in terms of staff at the state and at the MPO level, and then implementation, what we might change to reduce GHG going forward. Second issue that's a big impediment is authority, and that comes in two aspects. One, the state's authority over the MPOs. Right now, ORS doesn't recognize MPOs or address MPOs, and so we don't have authority to require the MPOs to do anything. Now, it also begs the question whether the state should have authority to make the MPOs do anything, and you'll get different answers, but that's not resolved here. It's simply identified as an issue that needs to be addressed. And then secondly is the MPO authority itself. Land use planning. As Gail described, they're roughly committees that coordinate at the local level. They don't have authority to change land use. So I don't know that the MPOs want that authority, but we would need to think about that as we go forward. And then the last impediment I want to identify is citizen involvement. We clearly need to have a discussion with our citizens about GHG emissions and how we approach those.
So I'd like to turn to our recommendations, and I think it's really important, as John indicated, that to realize that the recommendations from this task force are part of a broader effort to meet state greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, and we are trying to frame our recommendations within that broader context. There were some principles that were developed and agreed upon by the task force. The first is that we have to provide flexibility. These are very different communities and very different sizes. And one size is definitely not going to fit all. Second, we need to coordinate with the ongoing planning efforts. So each of these groups already has to do regional transportation plans under federal law, so we need to make sure that whatever they do in terms of scenario planning and greenhouse gas emission reduction strategies fits within those efforts. And we have to recognize that the MPOs simply aren't going to be able to do this without additional funding, or at least the small MPOs aren't going to be able to. They lack the capacity. So because of that, we recommend a sort of a three-step process. First is that ODOT, with the Transportation Commission, would develop a state strategy, an overall state strategy for greenhouse gas emission reductions from the transportation sector, so that the metropolitan planning organizations and the cities and counties that are a part of them could see how they fit into that overall framework, and also as a part of that, developing the analytical and modeling tools that we need to even figure these kinds of things out. There are not any current... Oregon is one of the first entities. ODOT developed the Green Step model. We're extraordinarily lucky to have very talented transportation land use modeling staff. It's one of the first models internationally to integrate greenhouse gases into land use transportation analysis. But there's more work that needs to be done on the model. So we're going to try to get that statewide framework developed. The Land Conservation and Development Commission under House Bill 2001 has to adopt targets for each of these MPOs for greenhouse gas emission reductions. So those targets need to be developed. And then the third thing, which is really vitally important, is beyond even the modeling, we've got to develop the technical assistance, the guidance, the toolkit for the metropolitan planning organizations, cities, counties, et cetera, to use so that they know what can they do within the authority that they have to reduce GHG emissions in the transportation sector. So we're working on all three of those, and we're doing it in three phases, where over the next 2 years, between now and the 2011 session, we'd use existing resources to build the toolkit, build the statewide framework, get the statewide targets set. Then phase two would begin after the 2011 session in 2012, if adequate resources are made available, either through federal grants or other state funding, then the metropolitan areas would actually do the scenario planning to meet their allocated part of these greenhouse gas reduction goals, and it would be done as part of their regional transportation plan updates. And then the final phase would be you'd be doing updates of those regional transportation plans as required under federal statute. John?
It's one other recommendation that we haven't touched on already, and that is that the February special session up figure out a group to continue work on this to bring back recommendations for the 2011 session. That could be the task force. It could be a subset of the task force. It could be a new group. I don't know that it matters. Those recommendations need to address funding issues and the authority issues that I mentioned earlier.
With that, we're open to any questions.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the hard work that you all have done on this in a very, very short amount of time. I can only imagine what it took. I'm curious, funding, capacity, authority, these are all very clearly barriers. They're also sort of the classic hobgoblins of progress on any particular issue. What are the ways that we can accelerate the pace of this change? Is this the ODOT framework that you're talking about, or what are some ways that we can address this issue more quickly?
Maybe I'll start, and Mr. Van Lenningham can finish. Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey. I think the first and most important thing we need to be focused on in terms of accelerating this is really working closely with the federal administration to get funding that we think is going to be available through the U.S. Department of Transportation, because this is a very high priority for them as part of their climate change strategy. So we're really on the hunt to get discretionary, competitive federal funds to to fund this effort both with DLCD, ODOT, and the Metropolitan Planning Organization. So that's the number one thing from my perspective. The number two step really is, I believe, development of the toolkit, the guidance, because what we heard from the Metropolitan Planning Organizations is they're very interested in doing this. We have a lot of cities and counties that are adopting climate action plans. They want to invest in, they kept talking, they made several presentations about the opportunities they have to reduce GHG emissions through transit investments, through a variety of other non-highway mode investments in order to provide people with transportation choices, but they don't have any money to do those things. And so what if we can develop this toolkit that explains this full suite of tools, some of which cost more money than others, some of which are behavior change oriented, then hopefully we can accelerate change. John, do you want to add anything?
I do. One supplement to Gail's comment is that we think that the recommendations of the report will make us more competitive than other states with the federal government in terms of the funding that we expect to come down in the future. And that our land use program already has the kind of approaches that fit with what, where we think the feds are going. But I also want to note that Representative Benz asked us a relatively similar question yesterday of us and wasn't happy with our response then. But let me sort of summarize, because his concern was that we're essentially doing not much between
paper
now.
Paper pushing.
Shuffling, maybe. between now and 20 and the 2011 session. So here's what I think we're doing, and you correct me if I've left something out. HB 2001 already requires Metro and Central Lane and the two state departments to begin work on this stuff, the scenario planning and figuring out what we can do. Both departments will be doing working on that as well. Both departments are will be working starting now on a state strategy, setting the targets for the MPOs, and developing the toolkit. Gail noticed yesterday the state has some incredible employee skills already in these areas, national leaders. The MPOs made it clear to us that they want those three things before they go too far. They want a state strategy, they want a target, they want the toolkit, they want a way to evaluate what's in the toolkit. The MPOs are directed in the report, or we are asking the legislature to direct them in a special session, to start looking now. They're already doing their RTPs update. I think they're required to do them every 4 years for the feds. So they're in the process now, and they've agreed, and we've agreed that they would start looking at their RTPs now for things they can do right now. I don't know what they are. They say they have some ideas. And then both of us, the state and the MPOs, are directed in the report to begin citizen involvement, to begin talking with the citizens of Oregon about what this means, what the problem means, and what we can do about it. If we had a lot more money, we'd do a lot more. But the report recognizes that we were not likely to get new funding from the state this year.
Other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think I used the phrase paper pushing. I think what I said was, this looks like a hurry up and wait report. I think that was my exact word.
Or nicer.
Yes, right.
Or nicer.
Yeah. And just a couple of remarks. First, it's interesting. I, of course, don't have any cities in my district that have anything close to 50,000 people in them. But it seems that whatever district you're in, you have an opportunity to comment. Because lots of folks are concerned about water in my district. I'm concerned about pollution in everybody else's. And so it's interesting to see how this is working. Not because I don't think you guys have done your job. I think because you've done your best with what you've got here, I think. Mm-hmm. But I have taken briefly more time and looked at part of this. I see that it says on page 6 of your report, the LCDC take the lead in setting targets for GHG emission reductions for individual metropolitan areas. And I was surprised to see that. I thought that would be more of a DEQ exercise. And I wondered then exactly if that wasn't the most interesting part of this report. Is it?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, I thought I was going to get that question yesterday, and I didn't. So I see you got to twice, and it comes up. I think that's a really important question to ask, and I think that my answer would be that Richard Whitman, who's the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, has been asked by the governor to take on the leadership role among the state agencies on developing coordinated climate change adaptation strategies. So the Department of Land Conservation and Development is number one. They are playing that leadership role among all the state agencies. Number two, as the Department of Land Conservation and Development sets those targets, they are going to be working very closely with the Department of Environmental Quality so that the data that DEQ has on the emissions is available. But this is truly an interagency issue, because in order to set the targets, you need to know where are the emissions occurring. That's a DEQ air emissions to some extent, but in actuality, in order to determine emissions from the transportation sector, you need to be able to have the vehicle miles and by what kind of vehicle geospatially displayed. So you need to know how much does which kind of car emit and where. This is part of the mobile source program for the Environmental Protection Agency. But the real answer to your question, beyond Mr. Whitman's leadership role, is that as you look around the country at these efforts of GHG reduction strategies in the transportation sector, it's really the land use and transportation agencies that that work with the models that integrate transportation and land use, so that the analytical tools that we need to do to set the targets are all managed and operated by ODOT and DLCD through our joint transportation and growth management group. So we have this joint division that has the real expertise to do the analysis we need to do. And so we do need to involve DEQ, but we need to have the people who really know how to use these analytical models and data sets doing the work. And where the states have had their air quality agencies do the work, it's really gone nowhere, because it's disconnected from the transportation modeling and the land use modeling.
I would add that DLCD and ODOT and their commissions have the closest working relationship with the MPOs. The MPOs are very concerned about this issue, all these issues, and how they impact them going forward. I'll stop there.
I just want to comment on something you said in your question, Representative Benz. The legislation that created this task force and the work that the task force has done and the work coming out of the task force is all directed at these six metropolitan regions and reflects, I believe, the understanding that we have that, at least in the transportation sector, the lion's share of the reductions to help meet our state's greenhouse gas goals are going to have to come from those metropolitan areas. And it's not, as you would have better perspective on this than I, but it's not necessarily going to be easy. Some of what these scenarios tell us, the scenario planning tells us, may, you know, rub some folks the wrong way, may collide with sort of existing notions of how we're going to grow and move people and goods around the region. And but that's sort of the point, to illustrate what it's going to take. So I just want to, you know, underscore for members of the committee and members of the public the degree to which this reflects for urban areas of the state a real commitment to leading the way and making the reductions, doing it ourselves, not saying it's going to happen because someone else is doing it.
Chair Cannon, I just might comment and point the attention of the committee to page 13 of the full report, if you have it in front of you, to underscore the importance of the point that you just made. And I'm not going to do the arithmetic because I'll screw it up, but over half of the total light vehicle emissions in the state, which this bill addresses, are from the six MPOs, 36% from the Portland metro area alone. We are not going to get the reductions that we need. If you want to make your strategic investment in the place where you're going to get the most gain, you're not going to get it in Representative Benz's district. I mean, we're not going to gain much of anything by focusing on Representative Bence's district. But you look at the MPOs, and again, even between the MPOs, and this is the legislature is already in the Jobs and Transportation Act directed Central Lane and Metro to do this planning. We'll look at it. Metro's 36%, Eugene's 6%, and then it's tied with Kaiser, but then Rogue, Bend, and Corvallis are, again, really, they aren't contributing that much in the big scheme of things. So we definitely need to focus on the MPOs, and you're right. It's not going to be... I was about to say it's not going to be painless, but on the other hand, what we're hearing from these urban communities is that people really do want choices. They want choices in what kind of transportation infrastructure they use. They want it to be safe. They want it to be convenient. But they want choices. So this is going to be about providing those choices and making the investment so people do have alternatives. And making Oregon attractive for, and to Representative Bailey's earlier comment, we at ODOT are really very excited about the incredible work that we've done with our local government partners and the Department of Economic and Community Development to make Oregon a very, very attractive place for early deployment of new vehicle technologies. So whether it's Daimler, who's going to be building new energy-efficient trucks and designing energy-efficient trucks at their plant in Portland, or whether it's Nissan that is going to be introducing their fully electric vehicle first in Oregon because we've made the commitment to the electric vehicle charging infrastructure, that is going to really provide economic development opportunities and community revitalization opportunities in conjunction with meeting these greenhouse gas targets. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but we've already had some successes in the electric vehicle and efficient vehicle arena.
Great. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think Representative Bence's question highlights a continuing theme that we have discussed in this committee on this issue, but on especially on many other issues relating to climate change in this setting, and that is that it is an issue that touches many sectors, and that our agency structure is more of a Venn diagram when it comes to addressing climate change, and there is a need for continual integration and resource sharing and information sharing across agencies, and I'm happy to see that the Department of Land Conservation Development has stepped up with its capacity in working with MPOs and the relationship that it has in the modeling and the transportation sector, and is working very closely with ODOT and likewise ODOT with the LCD. But that it is part of a continuing theme of all hands on deck.
Well, thank you very much for your.
You're welcome.
We have time. Well, we're a little behind, but let's go one question here or comment.
Anything we're learning, actually this can be taken offline, so, but I'll say it on the record, you don't have to respond. If we're learning anything through this, and I think his Venn diagram, point is really a germane one, and about agency restructurings going forward, right? Either really fundamental or at the edges to say, hey, if you're going to try to impact emissions or vehicle miles traveled, just the size of your roads is not the only question, right? Like what sort of material they're made out of isn't the question, right? It's not, what the gas tax isn't the only question. And there's, lots of issues there. And if we're learning anything about how we should structure governance to, sort of try to achieve these outcomes, that would be really valuable. And maybe there's something you'd say here, but I'm happy to take that offline. And the other thing is, about outcomes, where does to the extent it hasn't already been answered, where the rubber hits the road, we're spending the money we're spending on House Bill 2001, projects that are already in the offing, projects that are going to happen, where, what's going to be there on on actually hitting some targets? Anything you can say about that would also be nice.
Let me respond and then John, first on what are the implications for state government organizations. We have two of our best thinkers in state government in the audience with Bob Courtwright and Jerry Bohard from DLCD and ODOT, and they're the ones who've done a lot of the heavy lifting and their staffs, and I think we need to reflect on that and get back to you on that question. I think there are lessons learned. I don't think we're prepared to address them right now. We have our hands full getting the report out. On the second question, which was, as we're moving forward implementing the program that was funded by the legislature under House Bill 2001, or for that matter, our general transportation program, whether it's the cities and counties capital construction program or our statewide transportation improvement program or the projects that are specifically called out in House Bill 2001, I think the most important thing to keep in mind from a legislative perspective is that we all believe, and I think we're unanimous in this, that we being the MPOs, the cities, the counties, at least most of the cities and the counties, and certainly ODOT, that if you look at the literature nationally and internationally, you need to do analysis of GHG emissions in the transportation sector on a plan level, not a project level. In other words, you need to look at a metropolitan area, which is an airshed, and the suite of transportation investments you're making within that metropolitan area, which is why we're focused on the regional transportation plans as the place to do this analysis. It is there are limited analytic tools available to do this kind of analysis on a project-specific basis. Oregon won an American Planning Association award for the GHG analysis we did on the Columbia River Crossing project. It's cited as the best analysis that's been done nationally. But no one on our team would say that project-level analysis is the way to go moving forward. That said, we have another task force advisory to the Oregon Transportation Commission that is now developing criteria for the Surface Transportation Improvement Program. You may recall in House Bill 2001 there were statutory criteria. We've had a group working for several months to develop, sort of flesh those out, develop more criteria. And what that group is trying to do, and I've been tracking what they're doing, is to match up those criteria for our capital investment program with the work that's ongoing under the 2186 process so that we move as aggressively as we can to integrating that planning level GHG strategy into the selection of what goes into the capital program. But all these pieces are moving simultaneously. We're just trying to make sure they fit together. Key point, you do the analysis at the regional transportation plan. You don't do it at the project.
I want to add, if I could, that that the MPOs want to get started, but we all recognize this is a long-term process. It's not a quick fix here. So we're going to be working over the long term to work on this stuff. That includes the legislature. The MPOs and the task force were quite clear that we need methods to evaluate the tools that we identify. So that's going to be built into whatever happens. And the report asks that you direct us to report back to you in 2 years telling you what we've done and how we've evaluated it and whether it's having any impact. And if not, what we should do next.
President Smith, final word.
Yeah, I just want to say one quick thing. As you bring up the CRC, I think the regional thing is important, and I would ask that as we do sort of modeling going forward, that we be careful when we use like a static, static traffic model or static development model. Because I also know the Bush EPA had significant questions about the project. Setting that aside, and I know we don't want this hearing to be about to what degree Benson's constituents should be paying for additional capacity for Vancouver commuters, which use most of the CRC. But setting that aside, I do want to be careful about making sure we do smart planning over the region.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And our final topic for this morning will be an update on the Territorial Sea Plan, and Mr. Bailey's become a good friend of this committee.
Good
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Bailey. I manage the coastal program at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. I always enjoy sitting in listening to Gail Ackerman and John Van Landingham. I learn something every time from them. I want to give you a briefing today, and I provided you with it's coming around now, a four-page memo that actually was a tool for me to organize my thoughts on what's going on in this world of not just territorial sea planning, but really a new era in the state of Oregon in terms of how we think about our ocean and use our ocean. As we heard in the hearing earlier this morning about offshore oil and gas, the state has chosen a number of years ago to go down the road of the use of renewable energy and renewable resources in our ocean. And now when that's becoming a reality with proposals for ocean wave energy, there's interest in a variety of technologies, there could be wind associated with that. This is serious business. We're introducing a new and very complex industry into a marine environment. It's highly dynamic, not completely understood. With an industry, as we heard from Nick Furman in talking about oil and gas, that's very valuable. And it's both economically valuable, it's culturally valuable, it's embedded in the fabric of how we think about the Oregon coast and ourselves. So, long story short, that's to say that in the state agency level, we take this very seriously as to how we move into a new era in using our ocean. The governor's been very instrumental in pushing this forward and in highlighting the value of this new industry, both in terms of developing a renewable energy resource that we're all agreed. I don't think there's any disagreement that I've heard that we don't want to be doing that. We've also heard that about the economic impacts. Oregon Ironworks and Clackamas is going to be constructing a lot of these. The communities on the coast will benefit. A lot of people who have been working in and around the fishing and maritime industry will be those who will be working to service these things, to deploy them, to maintain them, to do all the kinds of boat and maritime-related jobs that needed to keep this industry literally afloat. We're looking to examples worldwide in Europe as to how people are handling it there, their experiences. So there's a lot of moving parts, and I wanted just to give you a quick summary today of some of those moving parts that we are very much involved in. And it really, in some respects, Representative Bailey's analogy of the Venn diagram is absolutely true here. There is no agency in Oregon that's charged with developing and honchoing the renewable energy industry, let alone the wave energy industry, or as we're calling it, the ocean hydrokinetic industry, because there's a lot of potential technologies other than just wave. And so what I want to do today, we'll lead you through a number of the activities that are going on right now, and really any one of them is very important in this entire picture. And so before one of the things we're concerned about is before we jump on the bandwagon saying this stuff is great, make it happen tomorrow, there's a lot of things to consider. And so we're doing the best we can now to redirect a number of resources. We're providing some of our federal coastal zone funds to help do this. The Oregon Wave Energy Trust is putting their money into it. The Packard Foundation has stepped up. They like what Oregon is doing to look at sustainable energy use. They're helping to provide some funding for it. The industry itself is putting up some money. So a lot of people are kind of chipping into it to make this happen. The thing that the topic at hand, you'll see here, and I'll just run quickly down the list here without, don't pretend to read it. The Department of State Lands has begun the process by the Land Board very recently adopted administrative rules that would govern the leasing of the seabed for anchoring these hydrokinetic projects to the ocean floor. So that's underway. As you know, March of 08, the governor directed or was it March of 09? March of 08. Time gets away from me. March of 08, the governor directed not only the marine reserves process that we've all heard about, but directed our department to lead a process preparing an amendment to the Territorial Sea Plan for citing these wave energy facilities, and to provide that to our commission, with Chair Van Landingham, by December 1st. We were able to do that sort of, as we heard earlier, kind of an all-hands-on-deck type deal, where first there was an advisory committee from the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, worked on kind of the basic themes or the principles, the cornerstones of a plan for siting wave energy. And then through a rulemaking process in our department, we involved a cast of thousands in that discussion. Industry, the environmental groups, by industry I mean wave energy industry, fishermen, local communities, all the other agencies, and came up with what we're calling Part 5A. It's a new part of the Territorial Sea Plan that's really the policy, the standards, and the process. And we learned a lot from the Reedsport pilot project that's been proposed, that's been going through a very detailed settlement process of all the parties, all the stakeholders coming together over the course of about 2 years to try to understand the effects of placing not just a single buoy, but an array of buoys in the marine environment, and how you would build it out over time. What do we do when such and such arises, and certain effects, and how we're going to take care of it. So the settlement process really was a good first look at the kinds of issues that are going to be raised as we go through this. And those were then built into this Part 5A of the Territorial Sea Plan Amendment. And it was unanimously agreed upon by both the OPAC's advisory committee and then the stakeholder advisory committee in the rulemaking process. And that was adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission back in November as a part of our coastal management program. Now, as Paul Claren, my good colleague who's really done the heavy lifting on this and who would have been here today except for some surgery a couple weeks ago that precludes him from sitting in these kinds of chairs for a long time. Paul's comment was, okay, folks, our happy time is over because the tough part is coming, and that's the mapping. The areas that will be available or not available for this industry. As Nick Furman today said, you know, we've got an amazing crabbing industry as well as a lot of other fisheries that go on in near shore. You might look out on off the coast on any given day and you see a boat here, you see a boat there. It looks pretty empty. The fact is, when you map all these together over time, there is no part of the ocean off Oregon that isn't fished, and some are heavily fished a lot. In fact, that's been the major challenge for us and where we're spending a lot of time right now. And now I'll drop down to Territorial Sea Plan Part 5B at the bottom of the first page, and then over to fisheries mapping on the second page. We're committed to working with the fishing industry in the broadest sense, up and down the coast, to have them help us determine where the areas are that could be available for wave energy development, in areas where we simply should not be thinking about that. Under the statewide planning goal 19, we've got basically the requirement to protect areas that are important to commercial fisheries, and there's four or five criteria, and we've got the requirement to protect ecologically important areas. What we really need to focus on, at least initially here, is the fisheries mapping. That's never been done before at the scale and at the detail that we really believe we need to make these kinds of decisions. So there has ensued over the last year and a half a very detailed, a very complex process that involves Nick has been instrumental through the Dungeness Crab Commission getting his members and the fleets to participate. The Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association and Anna Husing has been very instrumental in working at the local level. Oregon Sea Grant Extension has helped to set up fishermen groups in each of the major ports to work with us. And as Nick said this morning, the source group in Coos Bay, which is, I don't know the whole name of the acronym, but they've been very instrumental in moving ahead where fishermen are actually sitting down with technical GIS folks from EcoTrust, who OCZMA has hired on contract. Now, the money flow is basically, we've contracted with OCZMA. OCZMA has turned around and as part of their work, contracted with EcoTrust to do the mapping. EcoTrust is actually sitting down with individual fishing guys and gals and mapping where they fish and for what and when and kind of what the value is. We've worked hard to overcome their concerns for the proprietary nature of that information. So as a hands-off sort of thing, EcoTrust then doesn't reveal those individual fishing areas, but what they're doing is aggregating them into broader maps that show generally where the entire fleet fishes and for what and when. And Nick just gave this to me today as the first product. What you get is a little map, and this is from the folks at Coos Bay, a little map that shows in shades from yellow to orange to red where the key fisheries are that the fleet in Coos Bay is concerned about. Now, we're also going to be working with the folks in Newport. The group's name is FINE, Fishermen Involved in Natural Energy, I think it is. We hope to work with the fleet in Tillamook, Astoria, and Brookings, as well as NSAT, which is in Depot Bay, which is very involved in their marine reserves process, and the folks in Port Orford that did this exercise a number of years ago. So, long story short, is this has taken a lot of time and effort to bring the fishing community into a working arrangement with us in the state agencies, because that has not always, frankly, been the best of relationships. And we cannot represent their interests in this planning process if we don't know where they fish. So we're working hard with them to get that mapping. Packer Foundation is helping to fund some of that work. We've helped to fund it with some of our federal funds. OED has helped to fund it. That's probably going to take yet another year. Our optimistic selves say another maybe 8 to 10 months, but these things always take longer than you expect.
Is there an assumption that fishing, or at least those sort of high intensity, those red areas and buoys are incompatible? I would assume there's some thinking that underlies the need to develop these maps related to our fisheries.
Yes, it comes under the heading kind of an area exclusion because of the way a lot of these, if you're thinking about a buoy array of, say, 100 to 200 buoys, they're all floating around out there lashed up by big cables with underwater floats to keep them more or less in place. And that's a pretty dangerous arena for people to be navigating in, particularly with fishing gear. So the way the technologies are right now in both industries, these are likely to be fishing exclusion areas.
Okay.
Now, for small boats, for recreational fishermen, it might be a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But our starting assumption is, and it's certainly the assumption of the crabbers and others, that these are going to be areas that they won't be going into to do a lot of fishing. So we'll be working with that. We're working on beginning a process now with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to aggregate the information we've got about the marine environment, because the second half of Goal 19 is to protect ecologically important areas. Our goal is at the end of this not so much to identify specific sites where wave energy could or couldn't occur, because the technologies are going to change over time, and the precise sighting is going to change over time. But the idea is to try to frame it so that there are some areas that are clearly off limits, and everybody knows that from the get-go. And these are probably going to be the super high-value areas for fisheries and the areas that are of ecological importance. The rest of it is probably going to be all what we might term in zoning a conditional use. It depends on the siting, the technology, the number of buoys, the build-up. I had hoped going into this that we could identify areas that would be a green light. Yeah, you can put them there. I don't know that we're going to do that, but we'll see how this mapping plays out. So that's been a very important part of this process, is to work closely with the fishermen, because they're the ones with the big stake in it, and you've got a new industry moving into town. So we think we can get there. I mean, it isn't that people are fighting over it. It's a question of working it out, and it's taking a little bit of time. Concurrent with that is that down at the bottom of the second page is the seafloor mapping, and that also is a very important project. And I wouldn't say it's a matter of good planning, but it's certainly fortuitous that the work that Representative Boone and others have done to find the funding and get that project underway and get that work completed That's going to be very, very helpful in this. I mean, we could probably do it without it, but that's going to really help us understand, and the industries, both industries, to understand the nature of the marine environment, the seafloor that we'll be anchoring on, and prevent us from making basically dumb mistakes. On top of page 3, because there's a lot of interest in this, our agency is building a website where all of the fisheries mapping work, the environmental mapping, all the meetings that are going on, that as well as the work of the Nearshore Task Force, OPAC, the Marine Reserves, there's going to be kind of a one-stop shopping website for all things ocean, and we'll be announcing that very, very soon. The Ocean Wave Energy Trust has been immensely important in this process, and they are funding a number of projects that if they weren't being funded, I don't know where we'd be on this, because they're answering some key questions that relate not just to sighting in the ocean, such as the cetacean study, the whale impact study, and the EMF, which is what's the effect of electric field around these cables in the marine environment. But things like the transmission infrastructure study and the regulatory roadmap study, these are very important. If we're going to build a mature industry in this state, we need to be looking ahead to really the regulatory environment and the bigger sort of the physical infrastructure as well. They've begun doing some work on a cumulative effects study, but interestingly enough, the Minerals Management Service of the Department of the Interior has just released a broad area announcement with funding opportunities for a variety of projects, one of which is a cumulative effects studies. And as I left the office this morning, I said to the team, let's go for it. We think that it's right down the alley. We need to be understanding cumulative effects over time. There's been some great work done in Europe, but we need to be bringing those models here to Oregon and building it into our environment. So these are the kinds of things that are going to help to support this kind of industry and our decisions that we make as we go forward. We've been having some real-world experience. You'll see at the bottom of page 3, it references the Reedsport Ocean Power Technology Project. That's a project that has been underway now for the last couple of years. That's the one that we've been working on the settlement agreement with them for a couple of years. They're hoping to get a buoy into the water this coming summer, and then, followed by 9 more in the summer of 11. It's intended to be more of a test project rather than a commercially feasible project. It's one thing to put one buoy in the water and look at it. It's another thing to see a number of them arrayed together. So that's we're looking at that off of Reedsport. They'll be working on that, we hope. Oregon Ironworks is going to be building these pieces of equipment, and that's a major investment there, too. Likewise, we continue to work on the environmental concerns, how we're going to be monitoring these things over time, the cumulative effects analyses, adaptive management. The principles for all of this is built into the territorial sea plan right now. But how this actually plays out over time, we're still working on it. There's a lot to learn about these things. Then briefly, some of these other developments in the world of wave energy. The West Coast Governor's Agreement on Ocean Health is really focused on the use of renewable energy along the coast. We'll be working with our colleagues both in off Washington and California, whether it's on this the wave energy, the hydrokinetic, or it's wind on wave, or a variety of technologies to share information, to share our kind of the policy and technical standards, to work with our federal partners, Minerals Management Service in particular, on mapping and other environmental studies. In fact, that's been a really key thing, is to bring MMS into a much more positive and proactive relationship with the states than formerly through the oil and gas process. The Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center at Oregon State, it's a joint partnership between OSU and University of Washington, will be very helpful in testing new technologies going forward. Then finally, as I said, the U.S. Minerals Management Service is becoming much more of a player in the funding, because if the technologies change, then we may not be seeing so much of development in state waters. They may move it further offshore. In fact, I was talking with Nick Furman a little bit ago about the crabbers and their interest. if you move it offshore, then you start moving away from some of these key crabbing areas. But that means some technical adjustments, some technological changes. So as the industry matures and changes, the federal government and the role through the leasing and environmental studies with Minerals Management Service, as well as FERC as the regulatory entity, that's going to be very important. So we're building those relationships now, and we're continue to as they mature. But so I'm going to stop there. There's a lot of moving parts that I think any one of which would be very interesting to you and your committee. But it's a complex ball game.
Representative Boone, do you have any questions or comments?
I have a comment, and well, two comments. Thank you, Bob, for all you do. And Bob is a key person in all this, and has been around a long time. And not to say that he's old, but he has been around. He knows a lot of the history of all this, so he's a great resource. I'm sure that that's why Jules is so smart, because he grew up on those were his bedtime stories. So,
it worked quickly.
Yeah. My comment is when we were just talking about it. If anybody wants to see it, I have it. I'll bring my other computer with the photo I got of a new technological upgrade for offshore wind, or it could be anything else. But the idea of because you hear Bob just said it's the cost of things as they move offshore, it costs more. Something like a cable's $1 million a mile or something. So anyway, if we want to incentivize or provide an incentive for them to be offshore, but to help them out a little bit, if you take the design, this design is a hexagon basically, and it's got windmills on, and it floats, and it's got windmills on all the points, and then it has one cable conduit to land, so they don't have to pay for seven different cables, so you can cut your costs by seven times in that sense. And it's and I just have to say it was developed in Sweden, so you know. Things are happening quickly in this sector, and Oregon is on the cutting edge, and nothing right now is in the water in the States. So everything's either in Canada or in Europe and Australia and other places around them. China's going to catch up quickly. We heard some stuff on that on our trip over there. But Oregon is well situated for this. And as Bob said, just collaborating with the other stakeholders, if you put it here, you're going to have problems. If you put it here, you might not have problems with this group. So I think a lot of working together and getting all the kinks worked out, and guys like Bob and his crew and others and the fishing industry, had Nick and Nancy Fitzpatrick earlier, could attest to where these places are in their areas. And we're hoping to get that map, as you said, mapped all the way up and down the coast. So it's not, and Nick was pointing out outside too, there are no secrets anymore. You can get programs where you can follow which fishing boat is where and what they're doing. So it's a really, really hopeful sign to me that we're going to be going forward into this sector in a very responsible way that's going to benefit everybody.
I feel very hopeful as well, seeing this level of planning going on at a really early stage for emerging industry. I wonder, though, whether we've learned what lessons you've learned from our experiences with wind energy. I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, perhaps we were in the same position with, developers beginning to knock on our door and, ample wind in certain parts of the state and a lot of similar, different but related set of issues, environmental, competing economic uses, et cetera. Are we at, can you put this in that perspective?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, thank you, Representative Boone, for those remarks. I must say that part of the fun of this project is getting to watch the great work that other people do. So I've got a couple of good staff, Paul Claren and Andy Lanier and others, are working on this, and it's fun to watch them in action. So I just get to come over and do the reports. Representative Cannon, it's been said that we are where the wind industry was 20 years ago. I don't know that that's really true. Part of this is complicated by the fact that the marine environment is so utterly different that the technological requirements, and plus the fact that it's a public commons. It's not somebody's private land. It's their decision to either put up a tower or not put up a tower. It's not that easy. So in some respects, technologically, it's probably where the way the wind industry was couple decades ago. But in a public policy arena, it's a whole new ballgame. We haven't been here before, except maybe in the OCS oil and gas, and there that was primarily driven by a very top-heavy, bring the hammer down federal process. And here it's very much of a grassroots working within the community. The thing I would emphasize is that we're a long ways from mature industry. What we've got are a lot of companies who are entrepreneurs looking to perfect a design and to test their capacity to do this, and then they're going to sell it. And the mature industry is probably a couple decades away. And by mature, I mean where it's operational, it's routine, we've got the on-land infrastructure, the expectation. Because of the geographic isolation of the coast, I think that's going to take a special effort to think about the infrastructure to accommodate this the energy coming on shore. In some respects, wave energy is more desirable than wind. You can see it coming. It's predictable. With the modeling, you can forecast it. Whereas with wind, it's much more fickle, as it were. So, at any rate, that's about all I can say on that characterization.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. Well, thanks very much, Bob. We'll look forward to continuing to follow this issue with Representative Boone's help and leadership. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close those informational sessions and close the interim committee on environment and water. Thank you, members.